Good morning, everyone. Let's begin then. Let's all bring our hands together then to pay veneration to our teacher, our master, and our guide, the supremely enlightened one, the magnificent one, the perfect one. Let us also take this moment to remind ourselves that we are here to progress on our path to ultimate liberation. And towards that purpose, we have dedicated our lives and committed ourselves in every way possible. We pledge our allegiance to the Noble Triple Gem, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. May they be our guiding stars. May they be the light that guide us from wherever we are to the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. So let us bring our palms together in veneration, observe the precepts, and continue with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
There's that smile. Oh, that's better. When you're here, smile all you like. This is probably one of the few places you can smile and no one's going to ask you something. No one's going to ask you for a favor, personal favors. Because you can genuinely smile here, then people will be happy that you're happy. Usually people are happy if you can make them happy. Don't you agree with me? Generally people just want you to make them happy. I'm not for a moment faulting them, because it is not that they're bad. You know now that there are no such things called bad people. Badness has got them. They're not bad. But we have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that people are always vexing about one thing or the other. And when a mind vexes, remember there are no women or men who vex. When a mind vexes, that mind seeks no other or nothing else other than salvation. And I don't mean the salvation that you're after today. I mean the salvation that they have always sought throughout their journey of samsara, because this is what you are doing today is very new. They don't know about this. Not half the world, 99.99% of the global population, they don't know what it is that you are doing here. So therefore whatever you do will seem to be at odds with what is normal. So much so that you should set a new standard for yourself. You can no longer be measuring yourself against the yardsticks that your neighbors, your schoolmates, classmates, your colleagues, they set for you. So don't you take Facebook, scroll through the Facebook wall of your friends, and then try to measure up to that. You will not be popular. Because you will not be doing the things that make you popular now among your friends anymore. You see, when you're on this journey, you're going to have to pick one way or the other. Most of you will be on the fence. That is to be accepted. It's reasonable. Before you got the Dhamma, you were on one side of that fence. And you were very comfortable there, weren't you? Just doing everyday, you know, everyday things, doing what everybody else does. 9 to 5. And then 6 days a week, or 5 days a week, 2 days weekend. And then Saturdays and Sundays would come and go, but those 2 days seemed like a treasure. So, when those 2 days would come, for some of you it would have only been 1 day a week, for others might have been half a day a week, it just depends on how busy you wanted to make yourselves. Because it was a never-ending rat race. Sound familiar? Yeah. Because there were standards that society had set for you, and you had to hit those standards. There were targets that were set for you, and you had to hit those targets. If you had to be someone in society, if you had to be recognized by your folks, by your friends, by your colleagues, there was a standard that they had set, and you had to achieve those standards. Ask yourself why you went through the pain of getting yourself such a good education. Education is important. We all need an education. Yes, I understand that. I'd be a fool to think that education is unnecessary. That would be only a fool who would say something like that. Education is essential. But just think about the education that you went through, the level of education that you had to go through. Among you will be doctors, medical doctors, as well as PhD doctors. Some of you may have multiple doctorates. Some of you may have other accreditations. Maybe you're a chartered whoever. Engineer, and so on. Accountants. You know, some of these targets you set for yourself not because you wanted them. There may be many among you who, when you were a kid, your ambition was to be a dancer. You liked dancing. You wanted to be an artist. You liked drawing. There were things that you liked to do, but those dreams and those ambitions were very short-lived. Because soon enough, what happened? You had society to please. Even to this day, you may still be on a path that you had not set for yourself. It was a path that society had set for you. And by society, I mean everyone else. Starts off with your parents. Once again, you can't blame them, you can't fault them for this, because they are also victims of society. They have to do what society says. Otherwise, you can't survive. It's ironical though, that we claim to have independence. We speak of national independence, we speak about personal independence. We say that we are human beings and therefore we have the intelligence to pick and choose what we want to do, what we like to do, and we can set our own paths, we can set our own ambitions. Unlike animals, we say. You say your pet dog cannot pick and choose where he sleeps tonight because it is the master who decides that. You say an animal does not get to pick or choose what he eats that evening because it's the master who decides that. And so we put the two of us on a scale and say, dogs, pets, animals, they are victims. They have to surrender to what others decide on their behalf. And then we put ourselves on the other side of the scale and say, unlike us, we can do whatever the hell we want. Really? I'll ask you a question and answer this for yourself. You need not shout out the answer because it would be far too embarrassing. I'll ask you the question. How many of you are today really engaged in what, when you were younger, you thought would truly make you happy? Just think for a moment. You thought you wanted to do something. How many of you are truly on that path? For most, if not all of you, that path got diverted. At various junctions in life, You wanted to go left and someone said, no, not that way. We are respectable in society. We have to go right, can't go left. Perhaps your grandfather said that to you. You were just being innocent. You went and took a seat on his lap. And you went there to listen to him give you a folk tale. And then he asked you, what do you want to do when you grow old? When you grow up, what do you want to be? I want to be a teacher. Because you loved your teacher from school. I want to be a teacher. And then your grandfather said, teacher? But Putha, in our family, we're all doctors. Teacher? Okay. Doctor. Don't settle for teacher when you can go for doctor. So now, you are indoctrinated. From here on, it was not going to be you who was going to decide your future. Your grandfather now had to say. He didn't know any different. He was none the wiser. All he knew was what his grandfather had told him. That's why he said, in our family, we are all doctors. So, how come he became a doctor then? Because his father was one. His grandfather was one. His society pushed him down that way. Ultimately, we are like zombies. Have you watched those zombie movies? What are they drawn towards? Flesh, blood. Humans. When they sense there's a human somewhere, zombies are drawn towards them. It's very much like that. In society, ladies and gentlemen, you are drawn by the current. The current takes you. And ultimately, everyone goes down whatever path they're pushed along. And then there comes a day when we all have to die because we're all born. And then on that day, you look back and you ask yourself, is that the life I wanted to live? People have these things called midlife crisis. You know what I'm talking about? Some of you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got that one, Swami. It's when there comes a moment in life, you think back at your life and you go, geez, this is not where I wanted to end up in life. I wanted to live like a fairy princess. Today I'm living this kind of life. My husband's left me for another woman. Or my wife has left me for another man. This is not the kind of life I wanted. I'm stuck in a job that I didn't want to do. I have a bunch of in-laws who I just don't get along with. Then there are colleagues at work, they just hate me. I hate them, they hate me. It's a mutual relationship. It's a hate-hate relationship we have at work. What's going on with my life? They say around the age of 40, you have this midlife crisis. But most of the time, there's not much you can do because you don't have an alternative. Most of the time. Some give up work, they start a business. They think, this is not going to work. I just want to be my own boss, do my own thing. Right? I've had enough with other people calling the shots. Now it's me, my car, my petrol. I'm going to decide what I'm going to do with my own life. So you pack up. You walk in brave and bold into the office room to see your boss and say, you know what, boss? That's it. Today's the end. Here's my resignation. He looks down from his glasses and says, are you sure? He looks above his glasses and says, are you sure? Have you thought carefully before you make this decision? Oh, yes. You only decided that morning. That morning you woke up and you thought that was it. That was enough. Yeah, because you had that midlife crisis. That morning. Quickly drafted that resignation letter. Actually, you downloaded one off the internet. And you handed it into your boss. That's it. Enough. This is the spur of the moment, right? You're feeling emotional right now. You're still blind. But instead of going one way, you want to go another way. You're still blind. So one alternative, which is as bad as the other alternative, because you're still blind. What you're about to do now is going to make a decision that you're going to regret later. A lot of people have gone through this, people are still going through this, people will always go through this, ladies and gentlemen, because when people have to make choices, they don't really look at all their options. I can't blame them for it, because they have not come across the real option. There are options and there are real options. Just take a moment to think back about your lives and ask yourselves this question, hand on heart. Did you really have the real options when it was time in your life to make those choices? How come you're still not happy then? Happiness always escapes you. Contentment always escapes you. Why do you have to live your life like a zombie? Always hoping that the next day is going to make you happy. Always hoping that the next encounter is going to make you happy. Always hoping not this wife, but my next wife is going to make me happy. Happens. Some people live from relationship to relationship. My next relationship is going to make me happy. They're looking for fulfillment where it cannot be found. You'd have better luck going after a mirage looking for water. You'd have better luck. These are the avenues that society will try and guide you down, ladies and gentlemen. Be careful. That's why I say, set yourself a new standard. Don't measure yourself against the standards that society have set for you up until this point. Up until the point where you came across the Dhamma, that would have been fine, because it mattered not which option you took, right? If all roads lead you nowhere, does it matter which option you take? If there's no way out of a maze, just imagine you were just dropped from the sky into a maze that has no exit. Okay? Now, does it matter which way you go? Whether you go left or right? North or south, would it matter? No. So until you came across the Dhamma, it mattered not which option you took. So don't you regret, oh, I wanted to be an engineer, but I ultimately became a teacher. Regret. No, those are not the things to regret. Because it wouldn't have mattered which one you took. Yes, you might have had a few more pennies in the bank. You might have had 3 cars instead of the 2 that you still have. Your house would have been 3 stories instead of the 1 story that it is today. But at the end of the day, you're going to leave all that behind. So, who cares? Why does it matter how much you have if you have to leave it all at the end? So these are not the things you have to regret. Let's make sure we teach our children the same as well. Sometimes people go and jump off a bridge because they just couldn't get through medical school or get into medical school. They go jump off a bridge because the A-level results weren't good enough. They wanted to go to med school, but now they can't. Now they have to do something to do with arts or something else. They have to go do bioscience now. They want to do medicine. Now they go jump off a bridge. Does it matter which one you take? If your goal is simply until the end of this life, then perhaps it matters. But this is just a bat of an eyelid. That's how long this lifetime is. The bat of an eyelid in comparison to your samsara. How much is one compared to infinity? How big is one compared to infinity? If you're infinitely in debt and I give you 1 rupee, does that make you happy? You can't fathom what I'm saying. Okay, you're $1 trillion in debt. Say now countries, they get into debt, right? So much debt, trillions of dollars in debt. I walk up to the treasurer and I say, here's my 5 rupees. Keep it. Use that to pay off the nation's debt. What do you think they're going to do for me? They'll give my 5 back and another 5 and say, use this to get back home on a bus. They're like, are you nuts? 5 rupees is not going to do anything. We are $1 trillion in debt. So, in the, you know, you get that, ladies and gentlemen. So, what I'm saying is, don't set your goals for the end of this life. People often think that, you know, career planning, these are the important things in life. Plan my career. You know, your career ends even before you die, right? If you live up to 70, what's the retirement age now? 60, for now. Yeah. In another 10 years' time, they'll say it is 70. And then another few years' time, they'll say it is 80, and then you won't live that long. So your lifetime reduces, but the time before which you are allowed to retire increases. We have to set ourselves some new targets, ladies and gentlemen. Set ourselves some new standards. But this is only your personal standards. When you're out in society, when you're out with people, you're out in the public, you have to conform to the standards that they set for you. That must not change. If they recognize that you're different, remember, that difference people don't like. Remember at school, there was one guy in the class who was shorter than the rest of them. What happened? What happened? He got mocked, got ragged, got abused, bullied. Yeah? There you go. People don't like differences. So if they see that you are different to them, if they recognize, if they identify that you are different to them, then you're going to become the victim of society. And then the people will make life difficult for you. If you're still at work, perhaps, you know, if they recognize that you are very religious, right, then they might not give you that promotion that you need. You're good in every other way, but they will not give you the promotion that you need because they're going to think, well, this man's a religious man. He's only committed to his religion. He's committed to his, whatever, spiritual liberation. Why should we give him a promotion? He's not going to care about the company. He's probably going to leave. That is possible. There are some places where people are wise, people are intelligent. There are some places where the managers, the supervisors, the seniors, they're more sensible than that. They encourage people to follow their own faith, their religion, and so on, right? And they wholeheartedly and warmly welcome and accept that. They embrace that, in fact, because they understand that a religious man, he doesn't sin, so he's not going to steal from the company. They understand. They appreciate that, and they're not going to have quarrels at work, at the workplace. They're not going to have fights at the workplace because they're going to be able to get over any hardship, any heartaches, and so on. They're not going to get stressed out because they have a superior truth to which they can aspire to. But that's not everywhere. They're few and far between. So when you're out there, remember, this is your natural habitat. Out there, outside these four walls, by these four walls, I simply mean outside the community that you are. If you at home, you're all like this, then that's fine as well. If you're all practicing the Dhamma, then it's fine as well. Remember, the Dhamma changes you. There's no secret about that. The Dhamma changes you because the Dhamma changes the way you think. If you are the way you think, then the Dhamma changes you. I mean, it would only be a fool who once understands that there is no pleasure to be sought from watching TV, continues to do that, unless, of course, to please others. That's why we don't have a TV at the monastery. But that's my natural habitat. Your natural habitat will be amongst those who are like-minded. It's always like that, isn't it? Even in society, you like to be around people who are like-minded. People have clubs, societies, get-togethers, right? These are all people who are like-minded. Your minds are changing. I tell you, your minds are changing because the Dhamma is seeping through the cracks and the corners and the nooks, and it's changing you. You're beginning to think differently about the world. People are going to take you down to the park, and they're going to look at flowers, they're going to look at the birds, and they're going to say, aren't they just wonderful? Aren't they pretty? Aren't they beautiful? Shame we didn't come here earlier. At that point, you're supposed to say, oh yeah, they are. Marvelous, gorgeous, aren't they? If you can one-up them, even better. At that point is not the point where you're supposed to say, listen, beauty is not in the flower. You'll get a funny look the first time round. Second time round, I don't know what's going to happen. They will call you a social piranha. Then people will start mocking you, right? And they may even start earning demerits out of it, right? So if you care about the people you are with, just make sure that when you're out there, you conform to what people expect of you. You don't need to go and do unmeritorious sinful deeds. That you can stop, right? Because you know you shouldn't be sacrificing your samsara for whoever, not even your mother or your father. Even if your mother or your father asks you to do something bad, you need not do it. Right? You need not do that. But the rest of it, doing most of the things that you used to do when you were back in society, if people expect that of you, just play along. But for your personal, in your personal space, on your own, have a different standard, have a new standard, set yourself a new standard. Because otherwise what's going to happen, ladies and gentlemen, is you're going to continue to compare yourself against what you see on Facebook, what your friends are going to post. If you still have to be on Facebook, then you have to be on Facebook. Otherwise people are going to start asking you, why? How come you didn't like whatever else they do these days on those things? Why didn't you comment? Why didn't you share it? Why didn't you like it? Why didn't you this, that or the other? People are hungry for acceptance. They're hungry for recognition. They need it. They're hungry for admiration. They need it. Your friends will want that from you. That's why they call you a friend. That's why they call you a friend. They call you a friend because when they come all dressed up, you say, oh, how lovely. Stop saying that. And see whether they're going to continue to call you a friend. All relationships are based on causes. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sharing with you a profound truth about existence. These are the laws, these are the rules that govern our existence. Sometimes we are just so blind to them. We just blindly walk. We don't know what's going on really behind the scenes. But this is the truth. Far greater is the hunger for appreciation and recognition than the hunger for bread. People will want that from you. So give it to them. I was speaking to my parents the other day. And I was explaining to them what I've been talking with you about, like how beauty is not in the object. And I said, every time you encourage someone to appreciate beauty, you're actually uttering a lie. It is in a sense a musavada. Because it is not a satyavada. A satya is the truth. This is a lie. But what I said was, people will come up to you. Amma, people will come up to you and they'll ask you, do I look nice? What are you supposed to say? Oh yes. Beautiful. Now you might wonder, aren't you being deceitful by doing so? If you don't genuinely mean that, Should you not just rather say that? But can you explain to them the Dhamma? Someone walks up to you in the middle of a party and asks you, what do you think? They've just bought a necklace. They're wearing it around their neck and they ask, what do you think? What are you supposed to say? Rupam bhikkhave anicca. Then won't you get labeled as the weird one, the awkward one, the odd one, the crazy one? You will. We don't need any of that baggage, do we? We just want to get to Nibbana. That's all. Do people need to know that we are getting to Nibbana? Should we like go bells and whistles? And blow our trumpets and go, we are going to Nibbana. Ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da. Should we announce that to everyone? Shall we throw a party and invite everyone and inform them? By the way, ladies and gentlemen, toast. I'm going to Nibbana. It's a personal affair. There is nothing more personal than your journey to Nibbana because the world doesn't get it. Remember when your little one came and asked you? Just little. He was very little. 5 years of age. He came and asked you, where did Ayya come from? Amma, where did Akki come from? Did you sit him down and give him a lesson on reproduction? You didn't, right? Why didn't you? Because he wouldn't get it. He just wouldn't get it. Because to him, mother and father are sacred. To even imagine something of that sort happening between his parents is not a thought that he would be able to grasp, compute, or even fathom. You wouldn't want your 5-year-old to think of you in that way. But there comes an age where he begins to understand this is biology. This is how humans work. To create life, this is what you have to do. They begin to understand that. At that point, okay, now I understand. That this is what must have happened. But even then, they don't want to think about it. Would you ever want to think about your parents in that way? You don't. Even someone who watches pornography wouldn't want to think about their parents in that way. Because they are sacred. Yeah? So in the same way, ladies and gentlemen, there are things that people just don't get. Nibbana is one of them. For that, you have to have an infinite amount of merits. Never underestimate that it is merits and the power of the merits that you got you here. I hope you always talk about this. You know, you might think, what merits do I have, Swami Nohansa? I barely make ends meet. To get here, I have to hire a tuk-tuk. I don't even have my own car. I live in rented accommodation. And this is the best I have. I don't have any jewelry. I don't have a big bank balance. I've never traveled the world. Although these were things that I wanted to do. What merits do I have? I'm just a very simple Simon. Right? So I come here and I listen to the sermon. Are you suggesting that I have lots and lots and lots of merits? I'm just a very average Joe. That's what you think. That's what you think. Yes, of course. To have a nice house, you need to have given a good house. That's how it works, ladies and gentlemen. To have wealth, you need to have given wealth. To have beauty, you need to have given beauty. But to have Nibbana, you need to have given Nibbana. They're very different things. You need to have guided someone to the truth. That is what you have given, and therefore today you are guided to the truth. What you give is what you get. So if perhaps in a previous life, when you saw a beggar, you just couldn't stand the sight of beggars. I mean, not in a bad way. You wanted to help them. So therefore, every time you had some food, or if you saw a beggar somewhere on the street, you would go home and you would cook just for that. And you'd pack them some meals and then go and offer it to them. If that is what you did today, you'll hardly be hungry. Because you fed the poor. Therefore today, whenever you want to eat, food is always available. If ever you go somewhere, you will always have the best portion. Someone will always offer you something. You're never hungry. But there are people out there like that. They just don't have Nibbana though. That's a different matter. Oh, it's a different kettle of fish. It is. That's why you see, you know, just think about this for a second. You know, today in society, we have a class. There's the rich. There's the super rich. Then there's the ultra rich. Yeah? I mean, there are billionaires and there are trillionaires nowadays. How come they're not here? How come they're not here? How come the richest man alive doesn't get to hear the Dhamma? If all merits are the same, then the richest man alive should also be an arahant, shouldn't they? If all merits are the same? It's not like that. What you give is what you get. With emphasis on the word is. What you give is what you get. So whatever you have today is what you have given. Whatever you don't have today is what you haven't given. So perhaps you don't live in the lap of luxury. Is that your regret? Perhaps you don't have a mansion. Is that your regret? Perhaps you never got to marry the woman that you wanted to. Is that your regret? You have no reason to regret. You know, you of all people are the least of whom should think about what you don't have. Don't they often say, when they go, you know, go to positive thinking classes, they always talk about this stuff. Like positive thinking books are all about this stuff. Never think about what you don't have, always think about what you do have. Right? I'm telling you, you people, of all people out there, are the least of whom should ever, even the thought should cross your mind, oh, look at what I don't have. How dare you talk about what you don't have when you have it all? This is what everyone is looking for. The Dhamma. Because this is the only path that gets one to ultimate bliss, true bliss, unconditional bliss. So never look, you know, browse through Facebook, check your Instagrams, check your whatever they have these days. Twitter? Is it still called that? Something else it's called today. Whatever. I'm behind the curve, unfortunately, now. I'm ahead of the curve in some other senses. And in that way, I'm happy. But in some other senses, I'm behind the curve. Oh, it's called X now, isn't it? There you go. So whatever it is, right, you go browsing the internet, you're on your phones, you're on your socials, whatever, you're on your YouTube, right? Don't ever look at those things and go, oh, how I wish. It's like a king who has it all, who looks at a poor man and sees that he has a beautiful wife by his account. And he thinks, oh, how I wish I was that man so I could have that wife. There have been stories in the past who kings like that, they give up their kingdom. They give up their kingdom just so that they can baby that woman. He's happy for 2 weeks. Because then he realizes it was all just superficial. What is beauty after all? A creation of the mind. That's the thing, people don't realize, right? They marry for beauty. They marry because they see beauty and they think, I'm going to get married to beauty, but they have to live with the wife. They have to live with the husband. You marry for one, but you get something else because beauty is in the mind. Right? That's just one example. My point is this, ladies and gentlemen, right? Please make sure that you don't measure yourself against the yardstick that society laid down for you and the yardstick with which you measured yourself up until the point you came across the Dhamma, because now all those measurements are wrong. If you measure yourself against those measurements, then you will feel like you're always wrong. You'll feel like you're always behind. You'll feel like you're falling behind. You'll feel like you were successful, but now you are unsuccessful. You're going to feel that way. Because there may be some of you who, even on a Sunday morning, you were out there in the stock market, checking your trades, doing some business, meeting clients, signing up new business deals, an additional day of work, earning some money. But today, you have committed whatever part of your week you can towards a different cause. So therefore, of course, the investment has reduced in that sense. But today, you're actually making a worthwhile investment. Never forget that. Never forget that. Today, you may not be able to measure yourself up against the people you meet at a party. You may still be invited to some, at least. Maybe not to all of the parties you were, but at least to some you are still invited. Those days everyone used to look at you. Today you look at everyone. Today you look at everyone and you go, I see what's going on in that mind. Plenty of raga going on in that mind. Lots of dvesha going on in that mind. Full of moha in that mind. Oh, how can I talk to them? How can I make an entrance and guide them to the Dhamma? These are probably the thoughts that are going in your own mind right now. Today when you go to a party, but those days you were the center of the universe. Didn't you dress to dazzle, ladies particularly, and gents? When you walked into the room, did you want all of those eyes to look at you? Didn't you love it when you walked into the room, that room just went silent? And then there was just a hush, hush, look at her, shh. Wow. You dress to impress. Remember? Your accessories, they were put on to impress. Your watch, it was meant to impress. Your shoes, they were meant to impress. You were a bunch of brands walking on two legs, remember? Free advertisement. Remember how you wore your cap but the other way around? To impress? Because everyone wore it this way around, but you had to wear it the other way around. Or to the side. So you could, you know, you're making a point. Hello, I'm here. Hello, I'm here. Excuse me. Ladies, gentlemen, I'm here. What were you looking for? Recognition. You were looking for admiration. You were looking for the world to testify that you are an identity. You are an individual. Today you are beginning to understand that this sense of individuality, this sense of uniqueness, this sense of identity is all madness. So what were you celebrating back then? Madness, right? Think about it. Think about how many hours you spent in front of the mirror. How many hours, if you added up all those hours, what are we talking? Days, weeks, months, maybe years even for some of you. You wanted to look glamorous because you wanted to make a statement. What was that statement? I am. That's the statement. I am. That's a full English sentence. That's like a full English breakfast. I am. You don't need I am here. I am. I am. Meaning? Recognize me. I am. Identity. I am. I am, and then you add other things at the end to the tail end of that. I am rich. I am beautiful. I am pretty. I am smart. I am intelligent. I am young. See? I am mature. I am childish. What's that song? I am ugly and I know it. No, I am. Yeah, you know the one. It was not enough for me to know it. Everyone else had to as well. You know the song. I'm ugly And you should all know it. Take a trip back down memory lane, ladies and gentlemen. These were the standards that you measured yourself against. Are you proud of that? Shall I pass around a sick bag? Just in case. Because the more you begin to understand this, the more you begin to take pity on the previous self. I often refer to my previous life as my lay life. Right? Then I say, in my lay life I used to do this, my lay house, my lay wife, my lay this, my lay that, my lay mother, my lay father, and so on. Now in the conventional world, people say ex, like my ex-wife, so on. Think about your ex-life. Before you chose the path of Dhamma, before you entered the noble path, think about that life and I ask you this question. How proud are you of that life? Would you like to come up to this stage and talk to the audience about how you lived your previous life? But weren't there plenty of times where you used to do that back then? People would say, please come up to the stage and give a talk on myself. And you would walk up to the stage and say, well, 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 this is the moment to shine. And then you'd give everything about yourself. You'd tell about your parents, you'd tell about where you've been, you'd tell about your hobbies, your interests, what makes you happy, and all those things. But today you realize, my gosh, all that was just nonsense. A chitta arises to recognize an object, that's it, and it passes away. Aramman vijanan lakkanan chittan. That is what a chitta is. But those chittas, they became an identity. You created a self within that, and that self had to have various attributes. You are very self-conscious. Were you not very self-conscious? Just imagine if you were in the middle of a room and accidentally you passed wind. You know what that means, right? I don't have to give you the colloquial term. Yeah. Accidentally you pass wind. Remember how that made you feel? If there was a glass of water, didn't you feel like you had to jump into that and drown yourself? Didn't you feel like someone shoot me? Very self-conscious. Because whose was that? It belonged to you, right? That's the thing. That F-A-R-T? Whose was it? My. Because if it was somebody else, you laughed at them. But when it was you, you know what you did? Remember? You slid down in your seat and pretended like no one could see you. Why? Self-conscious. When you have a self, you are so eager even to own a what? I can't say the word. Even an F-A-R-T belongs to you. I'm asking you the question, yeah, are you proud of that history? Are you proud of that past of yours? You know, if you're in the middle of a conversation and you burped, how embarrassed did you feel about that? Because whose was that burp? My burp. If someone else did that, you laugh at them. But if it happened to you, if someone tripped and fell on a banana leaf or a banana skin, then people laugh. But when it happens to you, you feel like you're committing suicide, right? Why, whose fall is it? My fall. See? Self-conscious. This is what jati does to you. This is what ignorance does to you. To whom does the wind belong? It's part of nature, belongs to nature. To whom does a verb belong? Whether so that's just wind ultimately. Either it comes out this end or comes out the other end. Who does it belong to? It belongs to nature. So why are you having a laugh about it? Why do you feel that it belongs to you? Why do you become self-conscious? All because of ignorance, ladies and gentlemen. So even to this day, others might laugh at you, but you needn't be embarrassed. But we live in society, we have good manners. Yeah. So if that ever does happen to you, what do we say? We say sorry. Pardon me. We say that. That we continue to do. But embarrassment? There's no need for that. This is the prison that you created for yourself, and you locked yourself in it, and then you suffered. So again, what I'm saying is, don't measure yourself against the yardstick that society laid down for you, because your friends will be posting pictures, video clips on Facebook and whatnot, and they'll be posting pictures of, you know, people going through this, like a man passing wind, and then everyone will be laughing at it. People will be commenting on it. People will be adding emojis to it. Right? People will be sharing it and talking, like just taking the mic. Right? And then you look at that and you think, my gosh, if ever that would happen to me, I'm just going to go and kill myself. Please don't measure yourself against the yardstick that society laid down for you, because that is a different world now. To them, you are aliens. To you, they are aliens. But they don't understand your way. You need to understand their ways, because you came out of that cesspit. They are still in there. You can't get them to understand and appreciate what's happened to you. You have to understand what's still going on with them. Don't hate me for calling it a cesspit, because it is. People suffer. Haven't you seen what desire does to people? Haven't you seen what aversion does to people? How sometimes very, very respectable, well-mannered individuals in society, desire gets the worst of them. It brings out the worst of them. And it cripples them. Many people have secret lives. Many, if not all. Secret lives. Secret wives and secret lives. Many. But you need to be mature enough today through the lens of Dhamma to recognize that this is simply the absence of Dhamma. That's it. If you can't see someone who is a victim of desire and appreciate them for being a victim of desire, you're just as bad. Yes or no? If you can't look at a victim of desire, that, you know, what does a doctor do? When a doctor receives a patient, a doctor must always look at a patient as someone who is ailing. They're unwell. They need treatment. Right? So the doctor starts treating the patient and then helps them recover and get back to good health. In the same manner, ladies and gentlemen, today you understand that there are ailments that infect the mind. There are viruses that infect the mind. There are cancers that get the mind. You are capable of looking at this now through this lens because you are now equipped with the Dhamma. That Dhamma should guide you to help you make the right choices in life, so that whenever you see someone crippled by desire, crippled by aversion, crippled by delusion, understand that they are a cripple because of desire. Otherwise, you're just as bad. That is the other side of the picture. Now that you're progressing in the Dhamma, you will begin to realize that you don't do some of the things that you used to do. Some of the things that your friends used to do, you used to do, you don't do anymore. But your friends still do them. People you know still do them. you have no right to look down on them. Remember, we always love the sinner. We hate the sin, but we love the sinner. People only sin because they feel they have no choice. Whether you agree with me or not, that is the truth. People only sin because they feel they have no choice. When the mind vexes, it is like the pressure cooker. Once the pressure is built up in that cooker, there is no option. Either you blow the whole thing up and the pressure is relieved, or it has to come out of the nozzle and it makes a noise when it does that. There's no other choice. Because the pressure cooker does not know to switch off the cooker. It can't. It is incapable of switching the cooker off. But today, you are able to look at the world in this way. That is your greatness. That is how you elevate yourself to greatness. Become Mahatma. You've heard of Mahatma Gandhi. I invite you to become Mahatma. Mahatma means Mahatma, great soul. But you can be great in mind. It is not our role to look down upon people. If we did that, then think about our lives in our past. If there was anyone we'd have to look down at, mock, laugh, and ridicule, who should we start with? There you go. You know, I often give this, it's a bit of a joke, but take it lightly. I always say, you know, if someone comes up to me and says, Swaminathan, 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 please help me, that man is trying to hit me. Can you ring the police and put that guy in prison? I say, you got to put you in prison first. Why is that? Because you're getting something you have given. So who committed the sin first? There you go. If you have ever been cheated on, why is that? Because you have cheated. If something precious to you is stolen from you, why is that? Because you have stolen. Now whose fault is that then? That something is being stolen from you. It's because you stole. Justice served. So name one thing that is unfair in this world. I dare you. What's unfair? What's unfair in this world? Only you thinking that things are unfair. That is unfair. Everything else is fair. If when someone beats you, and you've been good, you've been a saint, and someone comes and shouts at you, and mocks you, and ridicules you in the middle of an audience, and you've just been a saint, if you're going to say that's unfair, yes, that is unfair. What is unfair? You saying that it's unfair, that's unfair. Because it's very fair. You're getting what you've given. So why did the Buddha, why do the Arahants, they try and stop justice being served on the victim? Why do they do that? You remember the story where the Buddha walked up to a bunch of boys and they were beating up a serpent with a stick. You've heard this story. And the Buddha intervened and he said, no, stop doing that. Don't do that. Wasn't the serpent or the snake getting what it had given before? It was. So why is the Buddha trying to stop these young boys from beating the animal? Out of sympathy for the snake? Out of pity for the snake? No. It's going to die anyway. If not by being beaten by a stick, then by something falling on its head. Some other animal is going to make a prey out of it. He had sympathy towards the boys. He said, if you do this, you're going to get this back. So stop. He was always there to save the sinner. Not those who had sinned. Because he can't stop Vipaka from coming your way. But once you understand how karma works, you can stop yourself from engaging in sinful karma. actions whose consequences you are going to suffer, you can stop them. But those consequences will come to you in the future. But if you understand that these are the consequences of these actions today, then you know, now you're knowledgeable, now you're aware, and so therefore you can restrain yourself. That is what the Buddha's Dhamma was for, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, in each and every one of your lives, you will have your pet peeves. You'll have something or the other you're not happy about. Just remember that everyone has something like that. You're not alone. Everyone has something they're not happy about. If it's not their mother-in-law, then they're not happy about their house. If it's not their house, they're not happy about their maid. If it's not the maid, they're not happy about their job. If it's not their job, they're not happy about how much they get paid. Right? If it's not that, they're not happy about the streets, or the street lighting, or the politicians, or the country, or how it's run. Everyone has their pet peeves. You are not alone. But I remind you, of all people out there, least of you, least of who should be complaining about what they don't have are you, Lord, because you have what everyone else needs. They may not want it yet, but that is what they need. Everyone needs what you have. They may not all want it yet. Today you want and need the same thing. Most other people, they want something else, but this is what they need. You understand the difference between the two, right? There may be some who you invited to be here today, but this is not what they wanted, so therefore they're not here. But isn't this what they need? There you go. Everyone needs the Dhamma, because the Dhamma is the truth. The truth is what shall set you free. It is the only thing that can stop you from suffering inside. So use the Dhamma to address your personal issues. We are not here to change the world. We are here to change the whole world for you. For each and every one of you, this is a personal journey. This is a personal adventure, one you've not been on before. That's why I advise you to both practice the path and keep this a personal affair, because you don't want to be publicizing or publishing this. You don't want to be telling people everyone about it. You don't want to be shouting off the rooftops to this about everyone out there. They're not going to want to hear what you have to say. People are not going to be happy about your personal spiritual development. You know, it'll be okay if you did it like this. A bit of Buddhism, a bit of religion, that would be okay. A bit of it, like, you know, it's a fashion. You're a fashionable Buddhist. If you were a fashionable Buddhist, people wouldn't have a problem with that. Because then they'd say, you know, she's a good lady. She goes to the temple once in a while. She's a good lady. She gives alms. They're a good family. That'll be okay. But there's going to come a point where people are going to start to say, that's too much. There's going to be a point where people are going to start saying that. It may come from your parents. It may come from your siblings. It may come from your closest friends. It may come from your colleagues. They're going to start to say, that's too much. Cut back, cut back, cut back. Remember what the Buddha said? Too much of anything is too bad. The Buddha never said that. But, you know, when someone wants an excuse, they'll make one up if there isn't one. It's like when you did, remember when you were younger and you didn't want to go to school? Didn't you make up excuses? My tummy hurts. No, I didn't. But my tummy hurts. Now we have an excuse. It's rainy. It's sunny. It's too cold. It's too hot. It's not you, it's me. See? Excuses. When the mind wishes not to do something, it will come up with excuses. You understand the reason behind that? Because the mind is vexing. So when the mind is vexing, the mind is very creative. That's a good point to take away actually from today. When the mind is vexed, that is when the mind is most creative. You know how creative it is? it creates an entire individual. That's how creative it is. It will create something from nothing. It will create beauty where it does not exist if the mind is vexed for it. That's how it is. Because the mind is capable of imagination. And you can imagine all sorts of things. Can't you imagine the girl who just glanced, and there was no intention of admiration or adoration or anything like that. She just glanced at you. Can't you imagine that she fancies me? It was only by accident. She didn't even intend to look at you, but she looked at me. She loves me. I'm going to get married and we're going to have babies. One glance. Because the mind is capable of imagination. The mind is very creative. An arahant's mind is not creative. It is simply responsive. It simply responds to the environment. That is the nature of equanimity. It simply responds. When a rupa arises, it perceives it and it passes away. It responds. Responds to vipaka. It doesn't create something that doesn't exist. You are all creators of an imaginary world and you live in it. You are creators of a fantasy world and you live in it. When you read a novel, don't you create a picture in your mind that sometimes even the author cannot create in the book? Right? So just think about this for a second. Listen to this. So you're reading this novel and it says, "It was a dark, stormy night." All I said was it was a dark, stormy night. In each and every one of your minds, there would be a lot more detail than that. Maybe you have a barn somewhere, or an old house somewhere, or maybe it's by the beach for some of you. Or maybe it's a full moon. I never said that. But you've already created that. All I said was it was a dark, stormy night. See? Very creative. So the crazier the people are, the more creative they are. So therefore they will create all sorts of stuff and they will keep posting it at you and bombarding you with information and saying this is the standard to which you have to abide, to live, to conform to. Don't fall for that trap. Please don't use the television as the Bible. It is not. Because the television will create a picture for you that is based entirely on what you are expected to live. These are the shoes that you are expected to fill because it is there for commercial purposes. Let it not be your guide. Who is my guide? The TV. No, don't be that. Don't be that person. On your way to work, perhaps you were in the habit of switching on the radio. Right? Maybe you listen to music. Maybe you get the daily updates on your way to work. Right? Maybe that's a habit of yours. And when you switch on the radio, they give you all sorts of stuff. Right? This is what happened in the day. This is the news. This is what's going to happen the rest of the day. And then they, in between and between what the daily going ons, they'll put in little bits and pieces about what makeup you should wear, how you should wear your hair, which film you have to go and see this evening, which restaurant you should go and try and eat out at this evening. They'll put all these little bits and pieces in there. That's why you have a favorite radio channel, because that is a standard that you want to live by. That is. The street you live in defines the standard that you have to live by, because you look at what your neighbors do. If your neighbor drives a Ferrari, then you can't drive a Maruti. You can't. Then you are not in the right neighborhood. If you keep driving a Maruti, they'll kick you out of that neighborhood. They'll say either live up or get out. They will. If your neighbors keep dogs, chances are you'll have to. Because, you know, and one way or the other, because they'll come to you, they'll walk up to you and they'll start talking about dog things. You know, these are my dogs, you know, this is how we look after them, this is what we feed them. What about you? Don't have dogs? Oh. You don't even have dogs. No. Should I? Yeah. Look at my ones. And then they'll take you and they'll walk you to their place and they say, look at these dogs. Go, you know, Tommy, yeah, come and play with Sammy. They say, no, you're playing with the dogs. And then they keep talking to you about how good dogs are, right? Not how good dogs are, how good the dogs are, right? And how enjoyable they are, how fun it is to have them, right? And then they just continue to impress you and indoctrinate you about keeping dogs. Next thing you know, 2 weeks later, you have a dog at home. Who's the dog now? You always allow your environment to influence you. That's why I say this has to become your new natural habitat. This community. I'm not trying to brainwash you, by the way. Okay? This is not manipulation. Well, if you like it, you can call it manipulation, but I'm manipulating you for the right thing. That's why. Therefore, I'm not ashamed of manipulating you if that is what you think I'm doing. It's okay, as long as I know I'm doing it with the right intentions. You have to get to Nibbana, don't you? Don't you? When? As soon as possible. Yes. So if that is what I'm manipulating you towards, what sin am I committing? So I'm going to paint a picture for you. Every day I'm going to give one stroke. Add another stroke, add a bit of color, add a bit of shading to this picture of yours. And I'm going to tell you the truth and lay it bare for you. This is how society treats you. They don't want you to be happy, they want you to make them happy. That's the way it is. Every neighborhood has a certain standard that everyone has to conform to. If their worktops are granite, they have to be granite, at least. If the garden's landscaped, it has to be, at least. If there's a fountain in one home, then there has to be one in every other home, at least every other home. It has to. If one guy has a swimming pool, then soon enough the others will also get one. That's the way it works, because it's constant indoctrination. That's what it is. Remember, you are the average of the five people you spend your time with. It's the way it is. I don't have anything against anyone having a swimming pool. There's nothing wrong with that per se. But what I'm saying is, if that is what you commit your life to, building a swimming pool, developing your house or your property so that you now have a tennis court and a swimming pool and a gym and the rest of it, if that is what you commit your life to, because you have to spend time doing that, you have to earn money, get your bank loan, whatever, work extra hours to do that, you're spending precious life which you ought to be spending on your salvation, because all these things you leave behind. I mean, that is my peeve. The fact that you commit your life to doing things when ultimately you have to leave all that behind. If I can say the same about your children, then what else is left to be spoken about? You must fulfill your duties to your children, yes, of course. You must fulfill your duties towards your family, of course. But draw a line somewhere. Don't sacrifice your Nibbana for them. Where are your children from your previous birth? Where are they? Where's your family from your previous life? How come there are still Khattariyas who have to bring the Bhutayas, right, or the Pretas? And they have to deal with them? And they have to make offerings to them. You know, but when they were alive, they sacrificed their Nibbana for their children. Today, what do the children do? They stick them in the bottle and put them in the middle of the ocean. at the bottom of the sea. That is what is left for them. But what did they do while they were alive? They dedicated, sacrificed their lives for their children. That's what I'm saying. Do your duties for your children, but draw a line somewhere. Do your duties for your workplace, but draw a line somewhere. I admit, you need a house to live in, but draw a line somewhere. You need a house to live in. You don't need a mansion to live in. I mean, there are young people in the audience as well. There are some who are just starting out in life. You are setting ambitions, goals, dreams for yourselves. I'm saying, set the right ones. Don't measure yourself against a yardstick that society is going to throw at you, because you will always fail. Remember, those who do that have always failed. Just because your mate wears an eye... What do they call them? Eye watch? An Apple Watch? Apple Watch. Just because your mate wears an Apple Watch doesn't mean you need one. I have two watches, by the way. One I got from Pamunua for 50 rupees. The other I got from the Apple Store for $500. Which one tells me the time? Which one tells me the time? Another one I got for 5,000, that's a Rolex. Which one tells me the time? You answer. But if I lose the one that I paid 50 rupees for, it's only 50 rupees I have lost, right? I don't even feel it. Just go and buy another one. But if you lose the watch, that's $5,000. Now you'll spend the rest of your life trying to find it. I often have pity on people who sacrifice their whole lives looking after their property, because that is the last thing they need to worry about. You know what? Because if you dedicate your life to looking after your property, ladies and gentlemen, it's such a waste. Remember this, when you die, you will come back and it will still be there. People don't realize this. They're looking after something they're never going to lose, because once you're dead, you'll come back for it. It's themselves. It's yourselves that you have to be looking after, not your property. It's yourself you have to be looking after, not your money. It's yourself you have to be looking after, not your career. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, you know, completely forget about your career, forget about wealth, forget about your existence and all that. No. There are certain things you have to do, but you have to be able to draw a line somewhere and say, you know, that's enough. That's enough. If I have somewhere to live, that's enough. If I have three meals on a plate, that's enough. If I have enough to feed my family, that's enough. If I can give my children a good education, that's enough. Draw some lines somewhere. Because you need the rest of the time to work on yourself. Otherwise, who's going to do that? Can your children save you from your samsara? They can't do that. You can give them a good education, but they can't give you nibbana. So where's your side of the transaction? What are you going to get out of it? And when you give something to someone, if you do it because you want something out of it, which is typically how relationships work, you want something out of it, the amount of merits you earn are next to none. So a parent giving everything they have earned, blood and soul, to their children, earns barely any merits at all, because you're doing it out of lobe. They're doing it because you're doing it for your own happiness, not for the child's. Hardly any merit at all. I'm not saying there's no merit at all, but hardly any merit, because it's still a human being. Right? So whatever merit you get out of serving a human being, you get that. But that is all you get out of it. And when you're dead, that's it. You have to be a good parent, of course. But please understand that duties and responsibilities are where you need to draw your lines. Don't measure yourself once again against the yardstick that society throws down for you. Because society will come up and tell you, when you're at the party, your friends will come up to you and ask you, you know, my child is going to this international school, where's your child going to? When they ask you that question, you feel like a deflated balloon. if your child is just going to the local school, you know, these are the problems that people who associate with other people have. No one comes and asks me that question, fortunately. And even if they did, I'd give them a good answer, they'd never ask me the question like that again. But when you live in society, you have to face these questions. People will come up and ask you, my child is going to that international school, my child is going to this college, where does your child go to? And then you have to now stand up, because you're in society, you're going to be measured now. You feel that. You feel that behind every question is a hook. They're trying to gauge you now. Where are you in your social standing? They're trying to measure you now. Are you the upper class? Are you the middle class? Are you the lower class? Because these answers will determine that. So if you say, my child goes to the local school, then the answer from the other side will be, oh, really? Oh. Didn't you try to get your child to that international school? All my three children are going to that international school. The education is very good, you know. These local schools, you don't know what they get up to, man. Now with every word they say to you, you feel deflated. It's like they're letting out the air that keeps the balloon that you are. And with every word they say, you feel hurt. Right? One word at a time, one line at a time, you feel hurt and hurt and even more hurt. Right? And then at that one point, you feel like you have completely dissolved. Now you have to build yourself back up again. Because you feel hurt, you feel undermined. Now what you have to do is, you have to go and try and get your child into that international school. So then you have to go and find out, how much are the fees for that school? How do I get my child into that school? Who do I have to go after? Who do I have to get the approvals from? Which minister do I have to get approvals from? Which politician do I have to go after? This, that and the other. Now you have to go do, just, you know, run like a headless chicken. You now have to go into go around doing that to try and get your child to that school. And then the moment you do that, someone will come from, some other family will come, they are from an even better international school. Their children go to an even better, their children go to a school abroad. So then they come and ask you, where do your child go to? My children go to the international school. Oh really? My child go to Australia. Oh. Once again, now you have to build yourself up. Because you feel undervalued, you feel undermined. You know, it started even when you were very young. Remember when you collected those stickers? These are the behaviors that we picked up as young children. Unfortunately, parents didn't know the harm that they were doing to their children by doing this, so they just let them play along. They were constantly measuring themselves. Moha all the way. So children, they collected these stickers. Remember when we were younger, we used to do that? So they'd come up to you and ask, right, which sticker have you got? I've got this one. I've got that. Oh, you've only got this one. I've got that one. So now they used to compare. This is when I was younger. Nowadays they must have many other things. And then used to be number of friends on Facebook. That's a big thing apparently nowadays. How many friends you have on Facebook? Apparently it's a big thing. There are children apparently who get symptoms of depression because they can't compare. The peer pressure is just too much. Do you think children suffer from peer pressure? You don't? Remember, next door neighbors, they have Rottweilers. You don't, right? Oh. How sad. The other side neighbors, they go on holiday. Every year, they go to the Bahamas. Where do you go? Hanta? No. We don't go to these local places, man. Riff-raff. Now you have to live up to that. Because, you know, when you get together, people are going to start talking about these things. No? Yeah. When you get around the dinner table, people are going to start talking about these things. Because remember, folks, people are constantly looking for recognition. They always want to feel that they are the better ones. This is a mind that is vexing. That's why. That's why they do that. When a bunch of girls get together, they talk about their boyfriends. And my boyfriend is this, my boyfriend does that, he's a boxer. He's a bodybuilder. What is yours? They talk about these things, apparently. So they tell us. When guys get together, they talk about their girlfriends. Look at my one, she's pretty, isn't she? Because if the girl's pretty, then that has value, and that value now is mine, so therefore I have value. See, this is value by extension. Once again, I tell you, I'm sharing these things with you because I don't want you to fall into these traps. These are social traps that people fall into, and then they dedicate their entire lives trying to come out of that trap. An entire lifetime. There are people I know who, at the age of 16, they saw a girl and they thought to themselves, their friends came and said, she's a hard one to get. At age 16. She's a hard one to get. Really? I'll get her. And then from that day onwards, for the next 25 years, he tried to get her. That was the purpose of his life. Human life? To acquire something that will perish? Just imagine, ladies and gentlemen, just imagine 25 years of this boy's life, he sacrificed to getting this girl, right? So let's say on the 25th year, he somehow unites with this girl. So on the 24th year, has that happened? No, it happens in the 25th year. So on the 24th year, she dies. Now? 1 year before the 25th year, she dies. Now what has he gained? Absolutely nothing. That's just one example. Then there are some who set themselves targets like, I have to have a big house. Because people talk about that. When people come together, they talk about that. When friends come together, they talk about that. They show off what they have. So the reason they show off is because they want recognition. That's why they show off. Having a big house because you need a big house is no problem at all. Have you seen my house? At the monastery. My God, it's big. Because we have to put 400 people in there. It's a big house. Have you seen the Anagarikaram? It's big. They have to put 120 people in there. It has to be big. Have you seen the sizes of our washrooms? They're big. Why? They have to be big. There's no problem with that. That was not because we fell victim to someone's sayings. It's not because someone took us on a ride. That's not why. Where there's a necessity, of course, we have to find a solution. This hall needs to be big so that you can all be here. But does your living room need to be this big? That is the question you have to ask yourselves. Does your living room need to be this big if all you have are 5 people at home? And one of them is a pet dog. Then there are only 4 human beings, 1 dog. Why does the living room need to be this big? Because society expects this from you. No other reason. That's why on your wrist you have a Rolex. Because society expects it from you. No other reason. Because the $50 or the 50 rupees, the 500 rupees, the 5,000 rupees and the 50,000 rupees, they all tell you the same time. No, mine's an atomic clock, Swami Nahansa. It's accurate to the microsecond. All right. So you schedule your work to the microsecond then. I've heard people who say, Mike, would you believe me? I've heard people who say these things. I got this clock because it's accurate to the microsecond. And they're always late. Why do you want time? Why do you want to know the time accurate to the microsecond? If you're always 10 minutes late? But people will invest in a watch that is accurate to the microsecond. Then they'll say, I got this watch because it can survive water at 200 feet. This watch will still work 200 feet underwater. What are you going to put it on your fish so that they can check the time when they're underwater? I mean, come on. And then they'll say, this watch, it stands the extreme cold. Even this is even good for the Himalayas. And he's 65. He just bought the watch. And he needs a walking stick to get around. But he just bought the watch because it will survive the Himalayas. Think about this. Aren't they just, people are just giving them a ride, aren't they? Why do people go on that ride? It's not because they want the watch. It's because they want recognition. When you walk into a sales room, right? You're going to a showroom. Do you remember the things that people tell you at the showroom? If you're ever going to buy a car or something of value, maybe a sofa. Do you remember the things that they tell you? A showroom is somewhere you can walk in the same way you got up in the morning. And they'll talk to you like they talk to a glamour model. You can walk in there, you don't even have to brush your teeth or wash your face or do your hair up. You can go into a showroom and they'll talk to you like you are a glamour model. Oh, madam, how good to see you. You look splendid today. You're walking in like Medusa, but they'll still appreciate you. Why? Because when you feel happy, when you feel joy, when you feel admired, you are more receptive to what they have to offer you. You will buy that stuff, even if you don't need it. Today on the way to Rajagiri, I saw a billboard outside. I'm not going to name it because it would not be right for me to do so. It was a board showing off, I think it was a jewelry store. So there's a picture of a woman holding her wrist up in this kind of posture, and it has an item of jewelry. I thought it was funny that she was also wearing a low-cut top. The advertisement is for jewelry. I wondered which one the jewel was. Just think about this. People fall for that. Otherwise they wouldn't do it. People fall for this stuff. They take you on a ride. Because research will tell them that 9 out of 10 men will look at that. 9 out of 10 women will also look at that. The men will look at that and wonder, oh, how I wish. And then they're still, the wristwatch is, or this, it's not a watch, it was some kind of jewelry. Let's say it was a bracelet. Right? So that's right against the object that they want to display. So what are they trying to sell? The bracelet. But they're showing something else. Right? So, but they've got the attention now. So the men look at it. Because the men think I'm a man and that's a woman. So that catches their attention. And they're looking at that thinking, oh, how I wish, how I wish, how I wish. Because that is a sight that they like to see. But they don't get it at home. So, disappointed. What to do? And the women also look at it. Because they grew up looking at the magazines, looking at the TV adverts, looking at the billboards, thinking that is the picture of perfection. If only I was like that, I'd be able to be more attractive. That is the yardstick that society has laid down. That's the yardstick. So young girls will look at that and go, right, so that is what beauty, that is the definition of beauty. That is the picture of beauty. That is what I need to look like. So people will look at me. Because people looking at me is an attestation of my presence. I am is confirmed. When you look at me in my eyes, you confirm that I am. That's why you look at me at my eyes. People take you on a ride. And I'm sure that those adverts must be really successful. Because now they've been able to display what they wanted to show. They've caught the prospective buyer's attention. And now they look at the brand name. And then they see where the shop is. And then they go in there and they buy it. Whenever you watch an advert, try and look at it through the lens of Dhamma. You will see it from a different perspective today. Whenever they show you an advert, look at it from the perspective of the Dhamma. That's why in an advert, everyone's always smiling. Because a smile induces a smile. When you're happy, you are more receptive. That's a fact. When the mind is in joy, the mind is more receptive to things. So when someone wants to sell you something, that's why I say you walk into a showroom, even if you walk out just the way you got out of bed, they'll still admire you. Because they just want to sell you the car, they want to sell you the sofa, they want to sell you the cooker. They'll always call you sir. But met anywhere else, they wouldn't call you like that. They wouldn't call you sir, they wouldn't address you like that. But at the showroom, because they want to sell you something, they'll call you sir. Don't fall for that. But I'm not saying I'm not saying you got to take it against the people who call you that or who show you a certain kind of respect just for the sake of them wanting to sell something. You mustn't take it on them. You must simply understand that this is how a mind works. That mind is vexed. That mind just wishes to get something off their sales book, their stock books. They want to sell you something. That's why they're doing that. You don't fall victim to that. You just understand why they're doing it. That's it. Now you've understood reality as is. Yatha bhuta jnana darshana. You've just seen what's really going on. That's it. You take it equanimously. What I'm asking you here, ladies and gentlemen, is don't measure yourself against the yardstick that society will lay down for you. They'll come and hold it up against you to see whether you measure up to it. Don't fall for that. If you're still subscribed to Facebook and you're still getting your media content from that, your social media from that, if you're still on YouTube and so on, because I can't ask you to get off it because you need that to survive. Right, you need it for things go on there. Sometimes that may be your source of the Dhamma. So I can't ask you to get off it. It would be unfair, and if you might need it for work. Right, so I can't ask you to get off it. It's not fair. But what I'm saying is, there's good stuff and there's not so good stuff. It's all there. When you open your eyes, things are coming in. They are flooding in. When you open your ears, things are flooding in. Each of these things have the power to influence you. Let them not influence you the wrong way. Where you're supposed to feel pity and sympathy, don't walk away having become a victim and therefore deserving of our sympathy and pity. Recognize that your mind will look for admiration. Your mind may look for recognition. In those moments, catch it. catch it and then zap it. Be observant, be vigilant about what your mind is looking for. If you are impressed by someone saluting you, speaking highly of you, praising you, honoring you, in those moments catch it and recognize that this is simply the mind gone crazy. It's looking for admiration. Don't fall for it. People will use it. They'll use it to exploit you. Once again, I'm saying they're not bad for doing it. They just have to make a living. That's what they have to do. They have to make a living. They have to pay their bills, right? They have a family to feed. They have children to send to a school. They have things they have to get done. They need money, so they will do it. You can't blame them for it. You can't fault them for it. You just have to understand this is what's going on. That's it. In the meantime, you must have the Dhamma, because they don't have the Dhamma. You have the Dhamma. Let the Dhamma work its magic on you. In these moments, contemplate on anicca. Remember we talked, and I'll come back to that, if not today, another day. We talked about the fact that color does not exist in the outside world. Yeah? The reason that we talk about this is not to give you a science lesson. I've said that to you many times now. Because science will also have plenty of evidence, and science can prove that color is not in the outside world. But here's what science says. Science says that color is in the mind, a constant mind. It talks about how you perceive color, not how a chitta perceives color. That is where science fails. Science also talks about cause and effect. But it talks about cause and effects of entities. It'll talk about you. Whenever science talks about you, they talk about your body and your mind. They might even talk about your consciousness. But they're talking about a constant entity. You are always a constant entity where science is concerned. Have you learned science any other way? Have you ever come across a definition of who you are in your science book, in your biology book, in your psychology book, in any other way? No, you've always been an entity. So there's been a body, there's been a mind, there's been a consciousness, right? But they've always been there as entities. What the Buddha teaches us is, that is not so. We are not fixed entities to whom things happen and who do things to the other world, to the outside world. That's not how it works. You are nothing more than a fleeting moment of a manifestation of cause and effect. That's all you are. In this moment you are born. What is you after all? Just a chitta. At the sound of this, that was one chitta. Not one chitta, but many hundreds of thousands of chittas. But if you simplify it for the sake of our discussion, a chitta, that's it. In that chitta, sound was heard. So much so that it would even be wrong to say that a chitta hears a sound. It is not that the chitta hears a sound. Hearing a sound is chitta. The whole purpose of the chitta is to hear the sound. So it's not that there's a chitta there waiting for sound to come. That's not how it works. It's not like you are here waiting for your eyes to bring you sight. That's not how it works. I'm afraid that is how science teaches us. You are there and then things go on around you. You're there and then you see things. You're there and you smell things. You're there and then you hear things. Yeah? That's why I am. Science will not deny this. But this is a lie. Science will not deny this. Whenever you said, I am, did your science teacher say, no, that is not so? No, but your Dhamma teacher will. This sentence is flawed. I am is an incorrect statement. It is false, it's not true. Here's what really happens. A chitta arises and passes away. This chitta arose to perceive an object. That object could have been sight, sound, a smell, taste, or touch, or even a thought. This chitta arose to perceive that object. Object, I don't mean a physical object necessarily, right? An object is a mental object, a sight object, a sound object, and so on. But that's not the only thing that happened. Unfortunately, this also is laden with ignorance. Ignorance is absence of the truth. This chitta bears true something that is not true. It thinks that existence is reality. It thinks that this is true. It believes, I'm talking about the chitta. This chitta, because of ignorance, believes that there is such a thing called presence. There is such a thing called existence. But the chitta cannot experience that. But if that's what the chitta wants, now the chitta goes into vexation. And what does a vexed mind do? A vexed mind is a creative mind. So now it's time to create. It creates what it doesn't have. And that is the paticca-samuppada process. You all heard of the paticca-samuppada process, the dependent origination process. The dependent origination process is the process that the Buddha simplified to explain to us how an individual chitta experiences I am. Don't you all feel this right now? Don't you all feel this right now? Don't you feel that you are? You are what? Oh, there's a plethora of things, right? You are a man. You feel that. I am a woman. I am a man. I am listening to the sermon. I am sat down. I am breathing. I'm looking. I'm hearing. I'm smelling. I'm 35. See, these are all things that are going on in your mind, because all of these are attributes about this I who is. Or who am. That doesn't even sound right. But you know what I mean. About the I who is am. I'm glad the queen's not alive. She'd have me executed. The I who is am now experiences all sorts of things about this presence. I am cold. I am Sam. I am young. I am 20. I am single. I am pretty. All of these things are creations of this I am world. Remember what's going on? It's just an individual chitta. Just a chitta. A chitta that was born to perceive an object. A chitta that was born to perceive an object is perceiving something that is not in the object. Now you might ask me this question, and it would be a very good question if you have this question in your mind right now, to which I'm going to give you an answer. So I'm going to answer, what's the connection between this I am and the object then? Let me answer that question. Let's assume that this object is a flower. Okay? This object is a flower. The purpose of the chitta, the pure chitta, is simply to perceive the flower arise and pass away, and to understand that the flower is a manifestation. But this chitta is ignorant. It is ignorant about the nature of anicca, that all there are manifestations, all there is cause and effect. That the chitta doesn't know. The chitta thinks that there are such things called entities. So here's what happens next. It immediately perceives an I am because it creates an I. So if it creates an I, then I am. Yeah? Because if there's an entity, it has to exist. This is the entity, this is existence. Do you get that? I is the entity, am is existence. So I am. The entity exists. Now, there's an object here. It's a flower. I am seeing a flower. Seeing a flower is a natural process. If you were an arahant, in other words, if the mind did not have ignorance, all the mind would perceive is seeing a flower. And even that, the flower, although I have to use these words, right, a flower would still not be an entity of a flower, it would be a manifestation of a flower. Remember, I took the flower the other day into my hand, and I asked you whether this is a flower on its own, or whether these are just the petals together. And then there was a bouquet somewhere on the other side of the table, I think it was on this side, and I said, right, so now you have a bouquet of 6 flowers. Take one away, you have a bouquet of 5 flowers. Take another one away, you have a bouquet of 4 flowers. Take 2 more away, now 2 flowers. Take 1 more away, now you have a bouquet of 1 flower. Do bouquets come in 1 flower? So at what point did it stop being a bouquet? So if you take the last flower away, now what happened to the bouquet? So a bouquet is merely a name, a conventional name that we give to an arrangement of flowers, right? These are really arrangements of flowers. So there is no such thing as an entity called a bouquet. That's the point I want to try and get across to you. That's why you are called a body. These things that you have sat on these chairs, you don't feel insulted when I say that, do you? These things that you have sat on these chairs, you know, they call it a mass. A mass. It's a collection. It's a body. Like a body of water is a collection of lots of water. So you are a body. A body is a collection of lots of things. Does that point make sense to you? This is what you are simply a collection of lot of things. The other day I showed you a video of how what you eat becomes you. If you may remember that video clip. Someone eats food and that food is decomposed, and then by using DNA that is in your bodies, it reconstructs them into the parts that you are. So ultimately you must understand that this is mostly proteins. So these are proteins held together, aren't they? By even more proteins. That's what you are. You're just a bunch of proteins held together. So you know, you see, if you can think of yourself or see the person sat in front of you, you will see a head full of hair. Well, most of you will see a head full of hair. Others will see a head. If you look at me, front row seats, I'm sorry, you won't see a head full of hair, you'll just see a head. But if you see a head with hair, don't you feel like there is one unit? Like there's lots of hair. There's hair. This is a hairy head. But ultimately the truth is not that. There are individual strands of hair. Although it looks like this is one thing, like one bob, ultimately it's just individual strands of hair. But your mind perceives it as one unit. That's the way the mind works, because of ignorance. Remember, an ignorant mind is a creative mind. So when the mind is ignorant, it doesn't understand this thing about manifestations. It perceives units. It perceives entities. So the first entity that it's going to perceive is I. That is when the mind perceives itself as an entity initially. This is what we call jati. Avidya paccaya sankara, paccaya vijnana, paccaya namarupa, paccaya salayatana, paccaya passa, paccaya vedana, paccaya tanha, paccaya upadana, paccaya bhava, paccaya jati. That is a dependent origination process. In English Dhamma books, it will have the word birth. Because most people think that this birth refers to a child coming out into this world through the mother's womb or whatever. That kind of birth. Or maybe a chick coming out of an egg. That kind of birth. This is also a birth, of course. Yeah, this is the birth of a perceived entity. In that sense, if you want to call it birth, it's fine. The birth of a perceived entity. But there are no such things. There is no real entity, because there cannot be. All things are manifestations. How can there be an entity? Don't you agree with me that this pen is merely a collection of parts held together? If I took the cap away, if I took the body away, the nib away, right, and the barrel away that holds the ink inside. If I took out all those parts, if I disassemble this pen, now where is the pen? If I bring all those parts together again you see a pen. If I take those parts out, take those parts away, there is no longer a pen. But you can't say that there is no pen, because then what is this? This is a pen, But this is just a manifestation of a pen. Manifestation simply means collection of things, aggregates. That's why they call skanda. A skanda, you know the Sinhalese word kanda, right? What is a kanda? Mountain. A mountain. What is a mountain after all? It's a collection of parts. It's a collection of sand. Lots of sand, lots of mud or whatever, right? You collect together, soil makes a mountain. So a mountain is a kanda. This is also a kanda. In Pali we call it skanda. In English we call it an aggregate. This is an aggregation of stuff, all coming together. In this form we call it a manifestation. This chitta, ladies and gentlemen, is also a manifestation. So once again, this chitta was born purely to perceive the object. Now this object was a flower. This object was a flower. The chitta wants to perceive an entity in existence because it thinks such things exist. Don't you? When you look at the person sat next to you, do you simply see a manifestation, or do you think that that's my wife, that's my husband, that's my mother, that's my brother? You see that, don't you? Like, you perceive that. But the truth is that it cannot be so because you both ate from the same rice pot. So if you both ate from the same rice pot, how can one be you and one be your wife? It's just matter. Ultimately, these are just elements from the periodic table. So is that your wife that next to you, or just carbons, hydrogens, oxygens and nitrogens? Why do you call her darling? Why do you call her honey? She's not honey. She's carbon, hydrogen, oxygen and nitrogen. She's just a bunch of carbons, mostly carbons. They're hydrocarbons. Hydrogen and a bunch of hydrogens and carbons. Then you have some oxygen, you have some nitrogen. These are very commonly available elements in nature, and that's what makes them. But in this way that they are configured, you give it a name. You give it an identity, because you have to refer to them in some way. You can't just call everyone carbons. You also carbon. This carbon is coming. That carbon coming. That the other carbon coming. Because they'll all be carbons, then, won't they? Aren't these two things made of the same stuff? Aren't these two things made of the same stuff? I mean, to keep it simple, right? These two things are made of the same stuff. But we call one a fan, we call the other a pen. Why do we call them? Why do we have these conventional names? Convention is for convenience. Let's remember that. Convention is for convenience. We need convenience in our lives. Otherwise, if you have to refer to this, you'd have to give the molecular formula of all of the molecules that make up this object. That's why instead of calling can I have some C6H12O6 please? You just say, can I have some glucose please? Or can I have some sugar please? You don't say, can I have a bottle of H2O, please? You don't say that. You just say, can I have some water, please? Why? Convenience. That's why. Because life would not be livable otherwise. If you had to remember the molecular formula of all of your friends, I mean, after all, aren't they just molecules, a bunch of molecules together? Right? So let's say, your younger one. Let's take you have two children. One child is 6 trillion carbons, 500 billion hydrogens, right? And 1 million oxygens and a bunch of other stuff. Now when you have to call him, what are you gonna have to say? If you're gonna call him by his molecular formula, then anyway. Can 6 billion carbons, 500 million hydrogens and 20 billion thousand oxygens please come? You can't because it's silly. So therefore you call him Dua. Puta. Pariputa. See? Convenience. No other reason. That's why they call conventional truths. It is a convention that we have come together and agreed. A convention. For convenience. But convenience, just because we come up with conventional truths for our own convenience, doesn't change the absolute truth. The absolute truth is still the absolute truth. The absolute truth is there's still this many carbons, this many hydrogens, this many oxygens, this many nitrogens, and so on. That doesn't change. And the other thing is, you know, once they have a shower, now the molecular formula changes. Because they're going to rub their bodies and then a bunch of skin cells are going to go down the drain. Now you have to give a different molecular formula. It's going to keep changing all the time. The moment they eat something, now again the molecular formula changes. So you can't, it would just be crazy. Therefore, we use conventional names. So that's why a flower is called a flower. It's not really a flower. It's just matter arranged in a certain way. For our convenience, we give it a name. If you and I can't agree on it being called a flower, let's agree on it being called something else. And from that day on, we'll call it that. That's how languages are formed. That's why in every language, they have different names for different things. Because it's a convention. See, sugar in English, let's say, is C6HLO6, or one form of it at least. In Sinhalese, we call it Sini. In Spanish, we call it azúcar. This is again sugar. But it's the same thing. Does giving it a different conventional name change the molecular formula? Does the absolute truth change just because we give it a different conventional name? No. In absolute terms, it is the same thing. They are identical. But for convenience, we give it conventional names. So when you put a flower in front of the chitta, it is the chitta's objective now to perceive this flower and to perceive it as a manifestation. But it can only perceive it as a manifestation if it is aware that all there are in this world are manifestations. But the unfortunate thing is, these chittas, unless they come across a Dhamma, they believe that what there are in the world are entities. So the first entity is ever going to create is this I, where the chitta believes that it itself is an entity. Now here's the problem. The moment the chitta becomes an entity, everything else in this world also become entities. So if something's an entity, it has to, what's this? Exist. When something exists, you must put it on the what line? Metropolitan line. What line? Timeline. So if something exists, it exists in the present, it existed in the past, and it will exist in the future. So the moment you feel that I am, now you also need to have I was, and I will. These three are extensions of I. You can't help this if this comes. If you create the entity of I, or if that is, you don't create it purposely, it happens in the mind. Again, that is also a product of cause and effect. If the entity of an I is created in the mind, ladies and gentlemen, you can't help yourself from feeling that you are present in the present. That you exist in the present. And that you existed in the past and then you will exist in the future. But you don't do it just for I. You do it for the flower as well. So therefore you say, I am looking at a flower. All that happens in this chitta. Part of this is vipaka, the other part is karma. Here's the vipaka part. Seeing a flower. Seeing a flower is a vipaka part. It's just vipaka. It happens to the Arahatunvanse as well. With the exception though, I have to make the point here, that the Arahatunvanse sees the flower as a manifestation. Okay, he doesn't see the flower as an existing entity. But in a mind that is yet taking on the Dhamma, or it is still a Pratakjana and therefore has not seen the Dhamma, that mind is ignorant. So that mind perceives, that mind thinks, it thinks that there is such a thing called an entity, and entities exist. So what the mind wants, it will create, because a vexing mind is a creative mind. So now that mind creates this entity. The dependent origination process is how the Buddha described how a mind creates an entity that does not exist. Actually, it doesn't create an entity, it creates a perception of an entity. Because entities don't exist, even in this world or in any other world, for that matter. There are no such things called entities. All there are manifestations. Do you all understand the difference between these two things? Please give me a show of hands if you are still struggling with the two. You don't get this point about these entities and manifestations. Is that still confusing to you? I'm more than happy to go over it 100 times. As long as you understand, because this is the crux of your understanding. From here on, you proceed. Because once you've seen that, you've seen jati. Once you've seen that, you've seen dukkha. Remember, dukkha is not suffering. Dukkha is jati. When the Buddha says that I have seen the first noble truth, he speaks about dukkha. Idam dukkha. Pubbe ananusutesu dhammesu chakkum udapadi. In English today, it's mistranslated. It says, I have seen the first noble truth of suffering. The Buddha never used the word suffering. Which is unfortunate. Which is very, very, very unfortunate. He speaks of dukkha. It has been interpreted that he spoke of suffering. He did not speak of suffering. It is not the first noble truth of suffering. But what can I do? You and I can't change that. It's too big now. We just need to understand it rightly. But, you know, if someone asks you, do you know the four noble truths? You must tell them, yes, it's the first noble truth of suffering. The second noble truth of suffering, or the cause of suffering. So you, whenever you speak to someone, or you have to answer a question, if you are taking an exam and they ask you in the question paper, you have to use the word suffering. Otherwise you don't get points for that, you don't get marks. You will fail the exam. But you need to understand, for your own salvation, that the Buddha didn't speak of suffering, because there was no need to speak of suffering. Everyone suffered without the help of the Buddha. What he came into this world was to explain to us, to show us that suffering is caused by something else. Suffering is not caused by suffering. I mean, that makes no sense. Suffering is caused by jati. The word he uses is dukkha, not dukkha. The problem is, in Sinhalese also, we have dukkha is the word for suffering. So when the Buddha says, Idan dukkhang, our Sinhalese scholars think that the Buddha spoke of suffering. And so when it's time to translate it to English, it is dukkha translates to suffering. That's what happened. It's a mistranslation. So therefore today people think that the Buddha spoke of suffering, and then they ask, should the Buddha teach us about suffering? Didn't we know suffering after all? Yes, it is true. In that lens, the Buddha never found anything for us. He's done us no favors. We knew everything that he taught us even before he came into this world, apparently. But once you realize that the Buddha's job was not to teach us about suffering, but the cause of that, this sense of an entity, which he termed dukkha, not dukkha, dukkha, that is not suffering. That's why in the dependent origination process, it goes to bhavapachaya, jati, and then jati pachaya. Now comes the dukkha. Jara marana shoka parideva dukkha domanasa upayasa piyehi vipayoga appiyehi sampayoga yam picchanna labati tampi dukkha sankittena panchapadana khanda dukkha. So what the Buddha is saying is, dukkha is what no one has ever seen before, and that is the cause of all this suffering. Everyone knew suffering, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone knew suffering. What they didn't know was what caused that suffering. So the Buddha comes into this world and he preaches to us, dukkha is the problem, and that dukkha is this entity. Answer this question for me. Were you sad yesterday about something? Or think about the last time you were sad or disappointed about something. When you think about it now, does it not make you sad still? At least a little bit. But that event has already passed. Think about something that you really loved, something that you really treasured, that you've lost. Even when you think about it today, you still suffer. How can that be? It is not you who lost it. It is not you who lost it. You know, even if we agree that, say it happened yesterday, right? Yesterday your pet fish died. Okay? So then when you realize that your fish was dead, you were upset about it. You were really sad about it. And you cried. In that moment your fish died, you were there. Okay, let's say you were there. But that is the moment that experienced the fish dying. Why are you still suffering about it when I remind you of it? Here's why. I say the word fish, a chitta is born. The chitta is born to perceive these words, that's it. But it doesn't stop at that. It creates an entity. It creates an I. If I am, I also, what? Was. So if I was, then everything that happened in the past happened to whom? Me. So therefore, the thing that happened in the past was a point of pain, was something that caused suffering. But to whom? To me. And that me was there back then, and that me is here now as well. Where does all that happen? In the present moment. In the present moment, you create an I am, therefore I was. So everything that happened in the past happened to who? Happened to me. Everything that's going to happen to me in the future also happens to me, because if I am, I will be. There you go. Did you understand that? When you create a sense, when you create an entity, you also create an existence. Because entities exist. I am. Entity, existence. I'm trying to simplify this as much as I possibly can. But not in a condescending way. I don't mean to, like, you are very intelligent, I know that. But I'm trying to keep it very simple so you can all understand this. There may be actually some few faces, few new faces in the room as well. And they're here. So, we have to cater to all. I is the entity, am is the existence. So therefore, I am. The moment you experience that something exists, it has a dimension of time. If there's a present, there's also a past. If there's a present, there's also a future. Now you have something that existed on the course of time. There's a past, there's a present and a future. But the Dhamma is timeless. You have just created time. Well done. So who's the father of time? You know, the father of physics, huh? The father of modern science. Who's the father of time? You create time. Time is created in the mind. A sense of time is created in the mind. When the moment I is created, the present is created. The moment the present is created, the past is created, and the future is created. See? Now here's the biggest danger. Here's the greatest pit, the greatest pitfall. Things happened in the past. Things happened in the past, such as your pet died, your mother died, someone in the family got a cancer, and they died. That happened 20 years ago. Today I remind you of that. The moment I say, father died of cancer, 20 years ago it happened, but as I say it, a chitta is born. A chitta is born to perceive just what I have said. All it has to do is to hear and pass away. Hear, understand and pass away. But you create an I. That happens in the mind, and the mind can't help it because the mind thinks of entities. And once it thinks of entities, it has to create an entity. Remember, a vexing mind is a creative mind. So if I is created, then I is exists in the present moment, therefore am. But 20 years ago was the past. So if I am, I also was. So if I was there back then, 20 years ago, whose father was that? My father. Who's talking about my father right now? This chitta in the present moment, because this is all there is. You know, when I talk to you about your pet dog who died 5 years ago, does that chitta come to you now? The chitta that you had when you saw the pet dog, your dog died, right? You saw it. That chitta that arose in your mind 5 years ago, does that chitta come to you now? Can it? Can it come to you now? No, because it's gone. Done and dusted. It's gone. So that chitta can never come again. That chitta suffered. I get that. Okay, let's say that's fair enough. That chitta suffered because the dog died. But why is this chitta suffering? That chitta died 5 years ago, but why is this chitta suffering? Because in this moment, this chitta thinks that it was my dog and I was there 5 years ago and that was my dog who died. It thinks of that right now. So therefore you suffer. That's how the past still haunts you. That's why the past still haunts you. Don't you have regrets? People have regrets. I did this, I did that, or I did all these bad things. I used to do all those bad things. I've done terrible things in my life. I was a robber. I was a murderer. I was a womanizer. All these things people go through people's minds. But what they don't understand is they are simply creating suffering in the present moment. They don't suffer because of the event that happened 5 years ago. It's not because of what happened 5 years ago. You're doing it right now. This is what they call the pachupanna moment. You're suffering right now, ladies and gentlemen. You're not suffering because of what you did or didn't do yesterday. It's not because of that. If you have an exam tomorrow, why are you suffering right now? Of fear? If you have it tomorrow? You know, the doctor has said your mother will be fine today, but she's going to die tomorrow. Okay? Your mother is fine today. He guarantees your mother is going to be fine today, but tomorrow morning she's going to die. She has a cancer. Why are you suffering right now? She's going to die tomorrow. Why are you suffering right now? Think about this. I mean, while she's alive, now you can't enjoy her presence either, can you? You can't enjoy her being alive in the present moment because you're already worried about what? What's happening tomorrow? Are you tomorrow's version of today? Seems like it. This is why people don't like to talk about death. Because death will happen someday, right? So I tell you, right, madam, you will die in 25 years' time. Is that a surprise that we're all going to die one day? Is that a surprise to any of us? No, but people don't like talking about death because they think it is they who are going to die. Because in the present moment, I am, it projects a future. In that future also, who is there? I am there. So therefore, what's going to happen in the future is happening to whom? Happening to me. So therefore, I suffer. That suffering is created in the present moment, not in the future. An event that's going to happen in 25 years' time, the suffering for that happens today. What a shame. It would be okay if the person suffered in 25 years' time, but why do they suffer today? Don't you think that's crazy? This is all because, ladies and gentlemen, jati happens in the present moment. Paricchasamuppada, dependent origination process, explains what happens in the present chitta. That's why we always say nibbana is something you have to do in this moment. Nibbana is something you have to do in the present moment, not in the past, not in the future. So when your mind recalls things you have done in the past, don't let your mind regret them. Because regretting is not something you do because of the event that happened in the past. Regretting is something you do right now because of foolishness. Regret is a punishment that good people give to themselves. Don't you agree? Regret is a punishment that good people give themselves. Bad people don't regret. Because if you regret it, you wouldn't do it then. Just imagine you lied. In the moment you lie, you're bad. Because this is a bad thing to do. But 2 days later, you regret. Now what's bad? Is it the lie? Or is it you thinking that it was you who lied? Which one's bad? Which one's bad? Not the lie, because that's gone now. That doesn't exist now. But when you think that it was you who lied, that's bad. Because in the present moment, you're creating an entity, and that entity exists. If it exists in the present moment, it existed in the past moment, so therefore that lie was uttered by me. That's bad. That's terrible. The lie was bad. This is terrible. Does that make sense? Thank you. Yes, madam. That's all right.
So now you just stated that what we give is what we get. And we are talking of the present and the present treatment.
Yeah.
How does something that we have done in the past then now come to our?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that question. It's a very, very good question. But the answer is also is even better than the question. The answer is better than the question. But I don't know how many of you will get it if I explain the answer. But I'll give it a go because the question has been asked. Disclaimer: if you don't understand this, just ignore it. Okay? What you have understood so far is good enough for your salvation. If you don't understand the answer I'm going to give to this question, it's okay, don't beat yourself up about it. But it's a very intelligent question. And the question was, if there is no such thing as an I, but what you give is what you get, then how come the givings always keep coming back to the same person? Perfectly valid question. Right, so I'm going to give you the answer to that, because this question has been asked before, and there's a perfect valid answer to that. But you may not understand it in the first go. I'll try it once, okay? Fasten your seatbelts. Here's the thing. This is a conventional interpretation of an absolute truth, or a conventional presentation of an absolute truth. In reality, because there's no such thing, there's no such thing as a you to get what you give. So, once again, if this part doesn't make sense, just let it go. Okay? But I will explain this further another day when we are all ready for it. Because here's what I don't want you walking away today after this part. It's okay to do whatever. Because Swaminarayan just explained to us that it doesn't matter what you do, it's not you who's going to get it. Because if you walk away with that, then it would be a shame. Remember, it's good people who go on to become great people. This is a lesson to bad people, so that they can become good people and continue to be good people. Because what you give is what you get. It's a timeless truth, but it's a conventional truth. The absolute truth is, there is no you to give or you to get. It's a bit like a boomerang. You know how a boomerang works. If you throw a boomerang, it circles, it goes round and comes back, not to the person who threw it. Although that's how we think it works. It doesn't come back to the person who threw it. It doesn't matter who threw it. It comes back to the point from which it was thrown. What if we swap the person with somebody else? Would it not come back to that person, or would it still keep going after that person who threw it? So you throw the boomerang and you run home. You think the boomerang is going to come and see you, come back to you at home. That's not how it works, right? But it comes back to the point from which it was deployed. That's how karma works. Although there are no entities, there are chittas. Okay? There are chittas. And chittas are formed in an environment. So this is a combined effect of a chitta and the environment. Excuse me. Every chitta leaves an imprint on the environment in which it was born. And the environment gives rise to the next chitta. So there's a mutual relationship between these two things. The environment gives the conditions for the next chitta to be born, and every time a chitta is born, it leaves, let's say, a message. It leaves an impact, it leaves an imprint, it leaves an effect on the environment. So every chitta makes a subtle change to the environment. That's why not everything you give, you get back. By this point, you may have done the sins that will bring you birth in the four great hells. But it doesn't have to be that way. Because if you can change the environment by creating the environment of a sotapanna, those karmas will never come back to you because it was not you who did them. Huh? This is advanced level. Hold on one second. So now, in fact, actually, this is university level. Okay. Otherwise, becoming a sotapanna and escaping the four great hells cannot be a reality. If you keep getting what you've given, right, then escaping the four great hells cannot happen. You have to accept that. The reason that you can escape the four great hells is because the Buddha's Dhamma, as it comes into contact with your ear, and a chitta is born. As you listen to the Dhamma, a chitta is born. That chitta, when born, has the, if it's born in the right conditions, if it has the right merits, if it is a chitta that is born during a discourse given to you by a noble person, that chitta has the power to change the environment which gave rise to that chitta in the first place. It cleanses it as it goes along. That's why there are defilements and there are cleansers. Kusala are cleansers. They cleanse. What do they cleanse? They cleanse the mind base. In other words, they cleanse the environment which gives rise to the chitta. What do defiling chittas defile? Because there's, you know, if a chitta only defiled itself, what's the problem? Because that chitta is gone before you even know it, right? So what's the problem? If a chitta is a defiling chitta, let it be. If it's just an individual chitta, who cares? But a defiling chitta doesn't just defile the chitta. It has the power to defile the environment which gives rise to chittas. That's why manopubbhangama dhamma. Mana is the mind, this is the mind base, if you like. To think of it like a well from which you draw water, just to give you an analogy. I'll come back to you, sir. Think of it as a well from which you draw water. If you take a bucket of water and you put mud into that, and you put the bucket back into the water, now the well is muddy. Yeah, you can keep doing that if you want. How did the mud get into the well? It was the bucket and the mud that we added to the bucket. So we put mud into the bucket and we put it into the well. And now the well is muddy. We can also cleanse the well. How so? We put some kind of cleansing agent. Instead of mud, we put some chemical that can cleanse the water. So we put that into the bucket and still put it back into the well. Those are called cleansers. Mud is the defiler. Does that analogy make sense to you? So with every bucket, you're either cleansing it or defiling it. What are you cleansing? What are you defiling? The well. The well from which you draw water. Make sense? Right. So the mind is where your chittas are born. It's what we call an indriya or a faculty. This faculty has the right environment. This is where all the conditions are for chittas to be born. You have heard this. Chakkuncha paticca rupecha uppajjati chakku vijnana. Then you've heard manancha paticca dhammecha uppajjati mano vijnana. When the mind comes into contact with the dhamma, a chitta is born. So there's such a thing called a mana. That is the dhamma pada stanza, mano pubbangama dhamma. Mano pubbangama dhamma, mano setta mano maya. Manasache paduttena basati va karotiva, and so on. So when the mind is pure, the chittas which arise from it are pure. When the mind is defiled, the chittas which arise from it are impure or defiled. In the same way, a defiled chitta also defiles the mind, and a clean chitta can also cleanse the mind. The relationship between these two are mutual. One does that to the other. So a defiled mind can give rise to defiled chittas. A defiled chitta can defile the mind. That's the relationship between these two. It's a mutual relationship. Now come back here. When we talk about giving and getting, I'll borrow another analogy here. Think of a radio transceiver. So it's a transceiver, it can transmit and receive. Just imagine this radio can only receive signals that were given off by the radio or at that particular frequency. So there's only one radio like that. Of all the radios in the world, there's one radio that transmits radio waves at a particular frequency. So what do we mean by a frequency? There's an environment within the radio that generates these electromagnetic waves at a particular frequency. Let's just say it's 50 hertz. Just for argument's sake. Oh, say 10 hertz, right? 10 hertz. So there's an in this radio, there's an environment, meaning a setup, some kind of setup, where there's an apparatus that's producing waves at 10 hertz, a frequency of 10 hertz. This is a transceiver. It can transmit as well as receive. So the antenna, which transmits signals at 10 hertz, can also receive signals at 10 hertz. Because when you set it like that. It can both send and receive on that frequency. Just as the boomerang never came back to the same person that threw it, but back to the same point, because the environment is such, the factors are such that it has to go cycle around itself and come back to the same point from which it was thrown. And just as the radio, once transmitted, will be received by an object that has the same receiving frequency. It doesn't have to be the same radio. As long as the frequency is right, it'll receive it. I mean, that's how we watch TV. They send it at a frequency. If you tune your TV set, so they send it at the antenna, wherever the radio stations are, they send it at a, transmit at a certain frequency. If you tune your TV set or your radio to that frequency, now they resonate. So therefore, this device picks up the frequency at which those signals were sent. Now, it doesn't have to go back to the same device, right? It has to go back to a compatible frequency. That's the key word there, compatibility. Compatibility means the environment is the same. Doesn't have to be the same entity, because there are no such things called entities. The environment has to be the same. Now what happens here is this. When you give, that is a moment where a certain environment is created. at that moment, at the moment to say you're giving a dana, almsgiving, at that moment an environment is created. In that environment, plenty of chittas are born. And through those chittas, you speak, you think, you act. Bhasativa karotiva. But it's the environment that has given rise to that, to those chittas. So they give. Now that giving has been done. So that giving has, let's say, escaped into the universe. That energy has escaped into the universe. That energy is there in the universe until there is something that is compatible. Somewhere, somehow, it doesn't have to be in the same place, somewhere that is receptive to that frequency, to that energy. When there are the right factors, the right environment that is compatible with that energy, 10 hertz, that will come back to that point. You and I perceive that it has come back to the same person. It's not come back to the same person. It's just come back to the same environment. The environment is created by a multitude of factors. When those factors come together, that is the environment. And that is how, when you listen to the Dhamma, your environment changes. So what your understanding of Sotapanna, as you become a stream enterer, Lobha Dosa Moha, or the Pancha Nivarana, these are defilements, these are cankers, if you like, that are eradicated from the mind. Sakkaya Ditti Vichikicca Silabhata Paramasa. Right? These are, you call them fetters. These fetters are eradicated from the mind once and for all. What that means, ladies and gentlemen, is the environment which gave rise to chittas that were there, that was there previously, has now changed. The Dhamma changed that. And because of that, any karma that was done by that environment which had Sakkaya Ditti Vichikicca and Silabhata Paramasa, which were perhaps karmas that had enough energy to bring rebirth in the four great hells, that karma is done. But that now that karma cannot take place, cannot take fruition, because the environment has now changed. The Dhamma made that change. In the same way, adharma can also make changes in the environment. So, rather than thinking of yourselves as entities, even your minds as entities, what I invite you to think of it is as simply an environment where things are going on. It's an environment where just things are going on. The knowledge that you have, the experiences that you have, the views that you have, the Dhamma you're listening to right now, you know, this is a concoction of all sorts of things that are going on right now. And there chittas are being born. So it's not what you give, you get. What is given at a particular, where a certain environment is present, what is given when a certain environment is present, if a compatible environment ever arises again, that which was given will come back. It does not have to come back to you. But it always does. Not because you are an entity. Not because it was you who did it. It's only because there is a condition that remains constantly. That condition itself is also reborn. Because even not even the environment is a fixed thing. Even the environment itself is a manifestation. Because there are no such things called entities or fixed things. Right? So the environment itself is a manifestation. But that environment keeps coming back together until your parinibbana. So that's why even Angulimala Maharaja Anvansa, or even the Buddha, who in a time where he was a bodhisattva, had committed some sinful deeds, they come back to him until his parinibbana. He had a headache, a backache that would never heal. Of course, you know, not things that he had done in his last birth, but many, many, many births ago. But why does it keep coming back to him? Even once he had cleansed the mind of all defilements, still there's a factor. There's a factor which is still present in that environment. As long as that factor is present in that environment, it attracts the karma that was done through that. But remember that that factor itself is also not an entity. It's also a manifestation. That didn't make sense to any of you, right? Question, sir? Vipaka. Yeah. Yes.
So once a person becomes a sotapanna, certain things are not received.
Yes.
So where are those things that are not received? God, where it could.
That's like asking, when I took this cap, this barrel, the nib, and this thing, these things away, where did the pen go? It didn't go anywhere. It just doesn't manifest. It's a difficult concept to grasp because it's very abstract, what I'm trying to explain to you, because it has no dimensions. It has no length, width, or breadth. It has no weight. It has no shape or size. And I understand that this is a tall order. I'm asking you to make sense of something that you've never understood before, and I'm not really helping you here. Or at least as much as I'd like to, because I'm explaining to you something that has no dimensions. And we've always known things to have dimensions. It's a bit like love. Think about that for a second. You love someone, and then you fall out of love. Where did that love go? When you fall in love with someone, where did it come from? Bring me the answer to that question, and I will answer this question. Exactly. Because things manifest, ladies and gentlemen. This is the point I want to act. This is the core of this, actually. There are no things that exist. We talk about energy being released and so on, right? But energy is not something that exists out there, waiting to manifest. It's not like that. Or rather, waiting to come to fruition, or waiting to sort of direct itself on something. It's not like that. These are purely manifestations. At no point in this universe can you take a snapshot and say, there's all the things. It's not like that. Nothing is fixed. So you can't really take snapshots of the universe. All there are manifestations at any point. They're only manifestations. So a moment before this present moment, it's not there anymore. But where did it go? You can't answer that question. The moment that's about to happen, where is it coming from? You can't answer that question. Just like when I ask you, when you fall in love, where did that love come from? Did your other half give it to you? So if that were the case, then when someone wants you to love them, but you don't feel that within you, you know, they can't give it to you. It has to arise within you, right? It will only arise when the right conditions come together. So when the right conditions come together, whatever those conditions are, you must feel that you are pretty, they deserve you, you must feel that they value you, you must feel, you know, feel protected, feel safe. You know, there are a million things that have to be right for love to arise in your mind. It's just a manifestation. But any one of those causes, take it away and you don't feel the same love anymore. Where did it go? Has it been replaced by something else? That's the thing. Where does hate go? You stop hating someone, where does it go? You feel jealous, where did it come from? So is there like a bag of jealousy somewhere, and we all just take our share, and once it runs out, no one else feels jealous until someone returns their jealousy? That's why there's limitless love. It's not like it comes from somewhere. In the same way, you know, this karma, this vipaka, is not somewhere. Yes, of course, we draw the karmic strand. Yeah? We draw the karmic strand and we explain how these are instances of vipaka or karma, right? And they will come to fruition and so on. That is simply a conventional interpretation so that you can understand what's going on. That's all. That's all. Yes, madam.
And so, even if there are, you know,
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we can borrow, you know, a few references from that, madam. Thank you. So, the environment is really the, you know, that's the biggest thing here. It's not the individual chittas. Although we talk about chittas, then you might ask me, the Swami says, why are you talking to us about chittas all the time? Why don't you talk to us about the environment? Because I can't change the environment for you. I can only change individual chittas. I can influence individual chittas, because remember, I have to speak to you, right? When I speak to you, it's not an environment that's born, it's a chitta that's born. By giving you the Dhamma, by saying things to you, I'm able to influence particular kinds of chitta. Those chittas, they go and do their job of cleansing the environment. That's why I talk to you about chittas. But ultimately, it's not the chitta that we are trying to cleanse. Because there's, you know, how can you even hold on to a chitta until you long enough to cleanse it? Yeah, if it's a chitta that attains Nibbana, then, you know, that will be a lost cause. Because how can you hold a chitta long enough to cleanse it? That is not so. Each chitta cleanses an environment. And just as the good lady suggested there, if you clean the environment, then although the jara germs in the environment, or the out there, you know, those germs can't cause you harm because the environment is clean. Likewise, if your mind is pure, and who does that? Who cleanses the mind? It's the chittas after all. Each chitta cleanses the mind. But once again, I need you to understand that we are not talking about a fixed mind here, by the way. Because then again you'll think, okay, the chittas arise and pass and away, but the mind is constant. No. There is nothing that is constant. That is the only constant. That there is nothing that is constant. Okay? So even the mind is born due to conditions that are there in that moment. So where there is no chitta, there is no mind. Of course there isn't. But where there's a mind, you can't talk about a mind that has no chittas. When the chitta is there, the mind is there. But that chitta, what it does is it cleanses the mind. Or it defiles the mind. That's why they call kusala chitta and akusala chitta. Akusala chitta are the chittas which defile the mind. Kusala chitta are the chittas which cleanse the mind. That's why they have their particular names. That's what they do. It's what they do to the mind. That's why they're named like that. That is why they have that particular name. Kusala is what cleanses the mind. Kusala, that's what it means. Akusala, what that means is it defiles the mind. So that's why we talk about individual chittas. And I can show you how a chitta arises and passes away. I can talk to you the same thing about this as well. This also arises and passes away. In the same way. Because this is not a fixed fan. There are causes constantly manifesting this. That's why at any moment, if those causes cease to exist, this fan will cease to exist. So one fine day, this nail is going to come off. Right? And then 2 days later, the fan is going to fall apart. The nail is going to come off, and 2 days later, the fan is going to fall apart. Or instantly. Instantly. Immediately. Immediately after the... Or not after. That's the thing. You can't talk about time. If I take this pin off, is it after that the fan falls apart? Is it? If you flick the switch off, is it after that the light goes off? Is it? No. So did you flick on the switch before the light came on? Please think about this. Right? We flick the switch. Is it after flicking the switch the light comes on? So is it before the light came on, I flick the switch on? No, ladies and gentlemen, it's no such thing. It's no before or after. I understand what you might be thinking, but it takes a while for the electrons to go from where the switch is to the light bulb. Let's say that takes no time at all. Okay? Because flicking the switch is not what's important for the light to come on. Electrons have to come into contact with the filament. That's what needs to happen. Yeah, so flicking the switch is simply, it's a facilitator, that's all. That's not what really flicks the light on. Because even if you flick the switch, if the wire was cut, then you have no light, right? So the electrons have to come into contact with the element. But do these things happen one after the other? No, ladies and gentlemen, they happen all at once. This is what the pachupanna moment is. Pachu or pratya are the conditions. Upan is born. When the conditions are right, an effect is born. Not after or before. The Dhamma is timeless. Not just the Buddha's Dhamma is timeless. The whole universe is timeless. So when did the Big Bang happen? The whole universe. 30 million years ago. Well, yeah. Yes. Come again? Yes. 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 Partly, madam. You have to have two things, don't you, before you can say whether they are the same or different? Yeah. To compare, they have to be two entities. So, if you ask me the question, if I do it, but the vipaka goes to another person, is that what's going on? We are asking that question on the basis that there is a me and there's another person. The truth is, we have to step outside that paradigm of thinking it in terms of, is it I who do it and is it to me those vipakas come, or is it I who do it and is it to somebody else when we are reborn? Normally we tend to think of it like that. If, you know, people say don't do sins because in your next birth you will suffer. Some people come up with the argument, well, if it's somebody else, why do I care? Yeah, some say, you know, you don't sin because you'll be born a dog and then you will suffer. It's the dog that suffers, not me, so why do I care? Do you think that argument is a valid one? No, because that argument itself is also based on a self-based view. Because when you talk about self-based view, there is me and there is another one. We need to step outside of that paradigm and start to think of the world in a very different way. There is no me whose karma comes to somebody else or to me either. Karma and vipaka happens. When a vipaka happens in a chitta, that chitta senses an identity. The problem is, within each and every one of you, each of your chittas are sensing an identity, and therefore you are taking credit or blame for a vipaka that was never yours. It was not you who sinned. But right now, as the sin comes to you, as it comes back to, comes into fruition, in this chitta, you are born. You give rise, you create a self. And that self thinks that it was my karma that's coming to me. Not so. So if you do good, it's not you who's going to reap the rewards. So therefore, what must you do? Not bother about doing good from here on, right? That is what I feared at the beginning of this conversation. That is what I feared you might come to. So please don't come into that conclusion. Okay? Because, you know, if you straddle these two worlds, it's going to be a little bit difficult. If you think of the absolute truth, you think of the absolute truth and you take actions in the conventional world, there's going to be a disparity there. Then the whole thing will collapse. Because remember, one of the dasavattuka mithyadhitti, or one of the wrong views, one of the 10 wrong views is that there is no point in doing good things, there's no point in doing bad things because it doesn't come to me and it was never done by me. That is the Dhamma misunderstood. And that is far more dangerous than not understanding Dhamma in the first place. But I love your question. It's a very good question. Is it another being that has to pay the price for my deeds? And that's like saying if my father has broken a bank, is it I who has to go to prison? That's not fair, right? What happens is there's a vipaka that happens. As in a chitta is born. A chitta is, let's just say, randomly born. Even right now, chittas are randomly born. I prefer not to use the word random. They are born because they're not randomly born. Cause and effect, right? So chittas are born. But in each of these chittas, ladies and gentlemen, jati happens. That jati is identical. The self that you feel is identical to the self that I feel. But then why do you and I feel differently? It's because of our baggage. It's a bit like we all have baggages that we carry on our backs. We have a bag that we carry on our backs. What we do is each time they ask you who you are, you have to take the bag out, open it and see what's in there. And then you come to the conclusion, oh, looks like I'm a farmer. Looks like I'm a fisherman. Looks like I'm a banker. Looks like I'm a father. Depending on what you have in your bag, in that moment, you decide that is who you are. That's how we travel through in samsara. One of these days, you're going to take one out of the bag and go, looks like I'm a dog. That's what happens. Because in a dog's mind, which is still a mother mind, as well as in this mind, the jati that happens is the same. Jati merely separates, individualizes, identifies as an entity. That's all jati does. This other stuff, the characteristics, the attributes, the what, the who, the why, the where, all these things, it has to be taken from memory. It has to be taken from the environment. It has to be taken by looking in the mirror. Those are all extra stuff that gets added onto the jati, which gives the jati a lot more detail. But at its core, if you just took the jati at its core, you and I would not be able to tell whose jati it was. Can you walk away with just that understanding, if nothing more? At its core, if you just take pure jati, okay, if you took just pure jati, think of it this way. Imagine they made robots in a factory. A factory where they made robots. But these robots, they dress up in different ways, depending on what the customer wants. Yeah? So there are no male robots or female robots, like the dummies that you have in the fashion stores, the shops, those dummies. Right? They're just plain. But you dress them up in different ways. Some you dress up in a smart attire. Others you dress up in casual. Others you dress in a frock, maybe in a skirt, maybe in a pair of shorts, maybe a hat. Right? Depending on what you dress these dolls or these dummies, you give it a different persona, a different personality. But at its core, they're all the same, right? They're identical. In the same way, you and I have more in common than we have than we have what is different between us. Oh, how I wish people would see that. There is more that unites us than what separates us. In each and every one of our minds, jati happens. And if you just took the jati and nothing more, you would not be able to tell two jati apart. So are you black or white? Are you high caste or low caste? Are you a man or a woman? See the profoundness that you are able to think through today because of your merits. Did you ever think you'd think about yourselves in this manner? 10 years ago? 5 years ago? 1 year ago? It feels so much like you don't belong to this world anymore, right? Don't you feel like that? Like you just don't belong to this world. Because now you think in a completely different sense, you know, your terms of definition, your terms of reference, all of that is different to what people outside, other people that you know, see the world and perceive the world in. Your entire terms of reference is different, has changed. You are an alien now. You don't belong to this world. You interpret the world in a very different way now. You now understand that you are just a chitta and there is more that unites us than what divides us. So then why even ask the question, should we fight for the rights of the blacks or should we fight for the rights of the whites? That very question is nonsensical. Because the jati has to be born first and then you stand in front of the mirror and then you realize, oh, I'm white. Right, let's go fight for the whites. Jati happens, then you go stand in front of the mirror and you realize you are black. Let's go fight for the blacks. Now, why is there disharmony then? You know, I'll let you in on something. From time to time, I talk to you about some of the work that we do at the monastery, right? The school that we do, the children's home that we do. People don't like to make donations towards religious things. Why? I understand why. Not you. People, because they believe religion separates, religion divides. They believe religion divides. We try to convince them that we are not here to spread a religion. This is a philosophy. This is a science of the mind. But until you listen to it and understand it, of course, they are none the wiser. They always think that this is religion. Do you feel that this, what I have been preaching to today, divides you or separates you from each other? Or have I not just given you the ultimate truth that tells you that you are all the same? Are you anymore a Buddhist or a Catholic or a Christian or a Muslim? Are you even a man or a woman? Are you black or white? Are you Asian or European? You understand that all these things are meaningless, senseless, futile conversations, right? But the pity or the irony of it is, when we go and speak to people and say, "Sir, we are doing this school, we are trying to help these children have a good future by giving them the Dhamma, we are doing this children's home, we are trying to give these children a good future." They're like, "Okay, we are happy to help, but you are a religious organization. You guys, religion, you divide. You cause disharmony among people." You fight for the Buddhists, but you don't fight for the Muslims. So in our organization, they say, this is what they say, "Therefore we don't invest in religious activities. It's good that you're doing a school, but we can't give you a penny, because you're a religious organization." What do we do? How do I convince them that this is not a religion? In the end, we had to form a foundation. We had to form a foundation and register it as an NGO. Because an NGO, by statute, cannot be religious for that purpose. So today there's a foundation called the Vimukti Foundation. Because that's what we are about. That's what we are about. Giving people Vimukti. Freedom. But we've had to go the extra mile to even get it registered as a non-governmental organization, because by statute NGOs cannot be religious. All that because people think that religion divides. So whenever we go up to someone and say, "We are doing a children's home, we are doing a school," sometimes I can't put myself forward. Because what do they see when they look at me? A man of the cloth. A clergy, member of the clergy. So the moment they look at me, no. Go, 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 go. Not a penny for what you are doing. That's why we are always at the mercy of those who understand what we are about. That's the thing. The sasana is at the mercy of those who understand what the sasana is. But there are lots of organizations out there who are prepared to invest in good causes like education, health, right, safety, and so on. But we can't go up to them and ask them for anything, because the moment I walk up there, you're a monk, you're a religious man. We don't invest in, or we don't give charity to religious activities. "Sir, we are not a religion." "No, no, no, you're a monk, go away." This is life. No good thing was ever easy. So this is why, like I said, we are at the mercy of those who understand what we are about. If you've been listening to this sermon attentively, this, you know, right from the morning, you will understand by now that this is not a religion. This is not to divide. This is to unite. If all of us are just chittas, each of these chittas, if there is jati present, we all feel the same way, no different. Your dog at home experiences I am in the same way that you experience I am. But your dog eats of the ground, of the floor, you eat off a plate, so therefore you say, I am eating off a plate, and the dog says, still I am, and then says, eating off the floor. That's where the difference is. There's no other difference. Because ultimately they're all just chittas. Chitta chayasika, rupa and nibbana. These are the absolute truths. And the shame of it is, if people knew what we were doing, they would have the opportunity to earn tremendous merits to help them on the path to their understanding the Dhamma. That's why I said, the reason that you're all here is no small reason. You can't undermine it, ladies and gentlemen. You're all here because you have paid the path to Nibbana for someone someday. That is what has brought you here to the presence of the Dhamma, the Buddha and the Sangha. We try to give as many people an opportunity to take part, get involved in the mission of the Sasana. But I have to go to them wearing a robe. I'm not prepared to put my robe aside and get myself into a pair of trousers and shorts or a shirt and go and ask them, because that's the thing, you know, we never ask people individually. We don't do that because, you know, individuals, they may have problems. Financially, people may be struggling, right? So if you ask someone and they feel obliged to give, that's wrong. That shouldn't be done. People shouldn't feel that way, that they're obliged to give. But unfortunately, out of respect, devotion, like when a monk comes and asks you for something, you feel that you have to give. Which is why the Buddha says, don't ask. Because people, out of devotion to the sasana, out of devotion for monks, out of respect, out of reverence, they'll feel that when you ask them something, they have to give it. So if possible, they would take out what they've eaten from their stomachs and give it to you, if they could. That is because of the devotion they have towards the sasana. That's why we don't ask any individual. But there are organizations who are willing to help. They allocate funds for these things, CSR projects and so on. But then again, we are damned there as well, because I have to go in a robe, or we have to say we are from the Jetavanarama monastery, and then they say, no, it's a monastery, it's religious. No. We don't want to hear about you, walk away. So that's why we had to set up a foundation. And then as part of the foundation, we sometimes say, right, this is a foundation and we are doing these charitable works, but we don't preach the Dhamma. we don't give the Dhamma, we don't give them any really, we don't observe the precepts, we don't do anything like that. These are just like, you know, some animals from the forest we've brought in to give them some education. We have to pretend like that, otherwise they'll think that we have a religious agenda. And you know, fair enough. We can't change the world. That's why I say we are always at the mercy of those who have benefited from the sasana. The sasana is always like that. The sasana always benefits from those who have benefited from the sasana. That's always how it works. So what's the first thing that everyone needs to do? Benefit the sasana or benefit from the sasana? Always benefit from the sasana. That's always the first thing. As much as you have benefited from the sasana, you will benefit the sasana. See, today I benefit the sasana with my life, because my whole life has been benefited from the sasana. The extent to which I have been benefited, I will benefit the sasana in return. It's always like that. There's a clock staring at me and saying you should have ended an hour ago. Does this make sense to you? Right, maybe not the last part I explained about the you and how karma and vipaka works. That's okay, because this was not meant to be today's lesson. This is meant to be like in a 10 years time. Actually, I probably wouldn't even talk to you about this until you become a monk. Or at least an anagarika. Because to understand this concept, you have to be engrossed in the Dhamma. Even understanding the Dhamma requires there to be the right environment. Otherwise, you won't get the Dhamma. You won't understand it. That's why merit is essential for one to understand anicca, dukkha and anatta. That's why we always keep talking about doing merits. Not because, you know, it's a fanciful thing to do. It's not so. Not because it's a trending thing or a fashionable thing to do. It's because merits creates the environment for you to understand the Dhamma, because it is not you who's doing it. It has to happen. That is all led by cause and effect. That's why. You and I can do something about it because we can understand the concept of cause and effect. So therefore, if we know that there's a particular effect that we want, we can create the right causes. That's what we are trying to do here. Right. Let's call it a day then. You got the I am part, right? I am, so I was, I will be. Contemplate on that. And do me a favor. Every time or any time you feel regret about something that happened in the past, please stop beating yourself up about it. Because it was not you who did it. Because the more you keep beating yourself up about it, the more difficult it becomes for me to help you right now. Because right now, if you don't have joy in your heart, which is what we call prasada, if you don't have joy in your heart, then the Dhamma doesn't sink. And there are moments where you lose that joy, and one of those things are when you regret about past events. That becomes a perfect trap. This is a problem that good people have. Bad people don't have this problem. Good people constantly regret about things that they've done in the past. Thereby, remember what I said the other day, goodness is the greatest obstacle to greatness. Good people regret about things they've done in the past, and therefore making their minds incompatible for the Dhamma to sink in. So please, whenever you feel that you have done something terrible in the past, something bad, something atrocious, something you don't even want to think about today, you can't forget them. I'm not asking you to forget them. Okay? Please get that straight. I'm not asking you to forget them. They'll come to you from time to time. Just tell yourself, Swamin has explained to me the other day that it was not I who did it. It was merely cause and effect. It was the chitta that was born at that time. Why do I penalize, why do I vilify the chitta that is born now for something that was done by a chitta in a previous instance? How does that make sense? How wrong of me to do that? And then come out of that guilt trap. Then it makes it easier for the monks, for the Swaminarayanas, for your Kalyanamitras to give you the Dhamma. Okay? Also, one final thing I want to say. Actually, two. There's the ordination ceremony on the 1st. Someone you know, Mr. Susit, who was our trusted chauffeur in and out of Rajagiriya, as I explained to you a couple of weeks ago. He'll be ordaining and becoming one of us, a monk. And he'll be precepting you the following Sunday. That's his plan. So he wants to come here and precept you as his first audience. How wonderful. The sense of gratitude that he has. They always talk about how it is this community. He's always talking about how you have given him an opportunity to earn merits out of bringing Swami Nuhasi back and forth. They always talk about that. It is because of this crowd, Swami Nuhasi, they tell me, that we have the chance to come on a Sunday morning to bring you here and give these people the Dhamma. Because they know if they give that, they get that. So they are very grateful to you for that. So that's on the 1st of June, which is a Saturday. That's the coming Saturday. And the second thing is, do yourselves a favor by doing this. And please take this the right way. Don't misunderstand me. Take it the way I intended. Some of the concepts that we talk about here, I urge you to not discuss this particularly with other teachers of the Dhamma. It could be monks, it could be lay people. And it's not because I don't believe in what I preach. It's because there are many paths to get to Nibbana. Yes, of course, there's only one path, but there are many avenues that can lead you there. And each Swaminuhanse or a Gihi Mahatya who preaches the Dhamma will have their own version of how they get to the Dhamma, to the truth. In just the same way that there is very little point in you coming and asking me something that you might have learned from a preaching that was done by another monk, at least a monk that is not one of at the monastery, there's very little point in doing that because I don't know why he might have said something like that, or why she might have said something like that. What was the reason for that? What was the background for that? What analogy he might have used to explain that point? There's little point in asking me those questions. In the same way, if you go and ask what we discuss here with another preacher of the Dhamma, that will get very confusing for you. If you don't believe me, try it. It will get very confusing for you and you will be lost. If I got a dollar for every time I met someone who tries to eat out of lots of different plates at the same time, they're never full because they're never nourished. And they can never taste the essence of the Dhamma because they're always dipping into different plates at all the while. So it's not a full meal. It's not a full meal. Just bits and pieces from everywhere. And then they get completely lost. There are people who go crazy like that. You know, we take responsibility for what we preach. But I can only take responsibility for what we preach. Not everything that you go and listen to. I can't take responsibility for that. That's reasonable, right? I'm not suggesting for one moment that this is the only place where you can get Nibbana from. That would be wrong for me to say so, and it is factually wrong as well. There will be plenty of other places. But I can't recommend another place because I don't know another place. I know my teacher gives me the Dhamma and that is enough for me. I'm more than content with that. So that is the path that I take and that is the path that I will preach to you. But if you choose this to be the place where you take your Dhamma, I can only recommend that you only do it from one place. If you take your Dhamma from another place, then I recommend that you don't use these sermons for your practice because it will be very confusing. That may get you to Nibbana. This, I know, will get you to Nibbana, but if you do both, you will be lost. You will be anything but Nibbana. So please do yourselves a favor and eat from one plate. That's a full meal. Okay? Let's all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by listening to the Dhamma, engaging in various meritorious deeds, creating a conducive environment for all those to come along and practice the path and receive noble association. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to have received the gift of Dhamma from the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the truth. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters, who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to all the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries, who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by delivering the sermons, sharing them out with others, transcribing them or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles through their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill their meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, and everyone and anyone who's gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've left no stone unturned, who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our God in deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom, and abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our loved ones, those who passed away in our name, our forefathers and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces, as well as the police force, who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who have lost their lives in the wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities, such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them, and therefore, with an abundance of loving kindness and compassion towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired throughout samsara, having done all sorts of good deeds. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land, and may you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success become a rahatan vahanse or an arahat teranin vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you.
Raga ginnen midatnva, dvesha ginnen midatnva, moha ginnen midatnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, mamada siyalu loka, siyalu satnvayo, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva, nibbana parama sukhayan, sukhita taravetnva. Raga gini niveva, dvesha gini niveva, moha gini niveva, nivan sap labeva, nivan sap labeva, nivan sap labeva.
Tunduange suvisi ananta maha guna belen,
සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්ත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.